cut its head off, you know? So that's basically where it came from.
Are you guys vegetarians?
Nope.
Congrats, bro. Say hi to the guys in the band. Here it is. Hats off to the bull. All I need is to put together. The Bowl from Chevelle, our brand new number one song. That's it for us. If you miss any part of the show, get caught up at thesideshowcountdown.com.
And download the free iHeartRadio app and listen to us no matter where you are.
I'm Nikki Sixx.
I'm Carrie Kasem.
And we'll see you next weekend.
The Sideshow is now over. Go ahead. Stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here.
Oh, let's see.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter
Werby.
Oh,
okay.
What happened?
Hi, everybody.
Where's our big intro?
No, oh, hi. Welcome to
Is
the Night Call Show. No.
Really?
No.
Oh, my.
Jade, are you listening?
Jade, you're a bad girl. This is called a cold open in the radio business.
Yeah.
And
but you know who's ultimately responsible for this? Me.
You. Yeah. I even said, is all the production up there?
Yeah.
You weren't listening to me, Peter Werby.
Give me the official ID.
the official ID, 101WRIF.
Yeah.
And WRIF HD 2.
No, 1.
One.
Just HD. Yeah.
Okay.
I think we're fired. Anyway, here's...
here's what the hell?
Normally what you'd hear was this big production saying that you're about to listen to WRIF's award-winning phone-in talk show, Night Call, starring Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. Actually, you don't say starring, do you? With.
Not starring.
With.
That, I mean, maybe starring would be more of a Broadway production,
yes,
or something.
And the announcer would say Peter and Jalene are going to give their opinions, and yours are welcome at 313-298-WRIF, which is...
313-298-9743. Maybe you should pull up the intro and we could start over, Peter.
I don't even know how to do it. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's numbers. I can't grab the numbers. But what you heard was the recorded shows that will be broadcast at 1 a.m. pre-recorded. Actually, it's not pre-recorded. What does pre-recorded mean? Pre-recorded.
Just recorded.
Yeah, pre-recorded means before being recorded.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that would be live.
Right.
Anyways, a couple of great shows. One analyzing the recall election in Wisconsin, but also a really interesting one on drug laws.
Right.
Yeah, wow, man.
Kind of the history of marijuana, mostly, isn't it?
Something.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'll
you
see.
Did the interview.
Yeah.
Rough
anyway,
start tonight.
Yeah, rough start. I wonder how this is all going to go. Yeah, good show. And the best part is we get to talk to you at 313-298-WRIF. If you want to email us, it's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And we have a Facebook that a lot of you are visiting. Facebook.com/nightcall. And
come on along.
Yeah, come on down. And we haven't been, sometimes we're real active on it.
It is the summer.
This is the royal we as well, because actually it's
right.
Jalene and Debbie that does it.
We do it all.
Yeah, we do it all. So, yeah, this threw me off.
Yeah.
But the show must go on. This is the test of a true radio veteran.
That's right.
And I'm totally screwed up.
No,
I'm not. Anyway, also, John is in for Athena and Sarah. Should we say about Sarah? Is that...
Go ahead. Sure. Sarah, one of our producers, just got the third runner-up of the Miss Michigan contest.
Nice. She should have won.
Congratulations. She's beautiful, yeah.
Yeah,
and smart. And talented,
yeah. You can't just be beautiful anymore in those things, right? Or can you?
I don't know. Yeah. I really don't. I don't really follow that. I only followed because of her.
Yeah. Anyway, John will produce our podcast. It will be available at noon tomorrow, Monday. And we'd also like you to like us. So go to facebook.com/nightcall. And one of the things, talking about drugs, this is an interesting comment from, I guess I can say both names because it's posted here publicly, right?
Sure.
Lorraine Lee says, I'm starting to have buyer's regret on the medical marijuana proposal that she voted for back in 2008. Puts legalized cultivation under direct police supervision, at least in theory. And cannabis as revenue cow probably means growing your own is still seriously illegal. Revenuers and all. You know, the revenuers were the people that tracked down the people that were making illegal whiskey back in the hills.
Oh, right.
Yeah, that's pretty. There was, what was it called? The Whiskey Rebellion, like back in the 18th century, right after the United States became a country. And they said, what? You're going to tax our hooch?
Right. Don't do it.
Yeah. Hooch, by the way, is... booze.
Yes. Well, then, I don't know. I think people, I have a friend who makes something called hooch today pure alcohol. And,
Well, let's, actually, I didn't even plan to go into this. But, you know, I was thinking how just repellent this election season is. You know, one of the things that the commentators talk about, they call it the silly season. Because everybody's trying to get everybody on an oops, like that even matters.
No, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. And everybody is all over everybody's single sentence and all that. And again, let me pose this to all of you listening. You can comment on this if you like. Why in the world don't they make a law? They probably, they might not be able to under the First Amendment free speech.
Okay.
But the government make a law say that the election season will be 6 weeks, not a year and a half,
right?
Yeah.
And that also you can't have any private money in it that will give every candidate a minimum amount of money. Maybe they don't need anything. What they should really have is FaceTime on television.
National television.
So you'd have a couple of debates the way, like, for instance, Abraham Lincoln had these famous debates, the Lincoln-Douglas debates. I mean, that was for the Senate back in 1856, if my memory doesn't fail me. How do these things get stuck in my brain?
I don't know.
Maybe I even had the wrong date. But anyway, I think it was. Anyway, people could the parties could develop platforms that people could actually look at and think, does this make any sense or not? You know, right?
Yeah.
But instead, they're going to spend like $1 billion. I mean, couldn't we rather have that for schools and roads, first responders?
Absolutely. These fundraisers, this past week was amazing how much both sides raised. And, you know, as always, the Republicans can raise it more swiftly than the Democrats, though it's a pretty close,
I think last time the Dems actually raised more.
Last week,
In 2008.
I mean, just this week, Mitt Romney had his, and then Sarah Jessica Parker had her star-studded fundraiser for
Plaza Hotel.
Yeah, $25,000 a plate.
$40,000.
And our Aretha was there.
Was she?
Yeah.
Wow. Detroit's own. But yeah, this is happening. Mitt Romney's been jetting around the country making frequent stops in the states that will not be battlegrounds this fall. California, Texas, Utah, and New York among them, in search of donations. He has events scheduled in wealthy enclaves from Aspen, Colorado, and Jackson Hole, Wyoming, to the Hamptons. That's out
of
New
course.
York.
Of course. And
so this goes on and on and on. President Obama rejected public financing in his 2008 race to free himself to spend as much money as he could raise, and this year he'll be the first sitting president to do so. If you accept public financing, I guess there's some, you know, break on all this. Romney and his allies appear to be on track to raise even more money than Mr. Obama and his backers. In May, the Romney campaign collected more than $76 million, nearly $17 million more than the president. Who is giving all this money? So, you know,
where is all this money? Yeah. Oh, it's in the 1%, I do believe.
Talk about the elites. I mean, this is the elites financing the elites. We're ruled by the elites, and the elites are competing among one another to get their particular candidate in. Mr. Obama, in particular, is under pressure to accelerate his fundraising to keep pace with Mr. Romney's team and the conservative super PACs, political action committees, that are pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into the campaign. But Republicans, even as they celebrate their own fundraising advantage, are trying to make Mr. Obama's exertions a political issue, suggesting he's not paying enough attention to his job.
Yeah, and there's the other argument that I've heard from a few people, that why is he using Air Force One to travel around and campaign on our dollar and our time? But every president who runs again does that.
Well, you know, I don't know on the face of it, but there's got, you know, those.
Because we bitched about Bush doing it.
I mean, that's not how we want our money spent.
Right.
Well, let's see. Mr. Romney said the president needs to go out and talk to people, not just do fundraisers. Go out and talk to people in the country and find out what is happening.
Well, I do believe he is doing that.
Yeah. The Democrats, if you think about it, though, they have a lot of millionaires sponsoring them and supporting them. And overwhelmingly, the Republicans have the billionaires. Dems have a couple, George Soros and the like. So they got the Democrats are trying to compete with the Republican fundraising apparatus by partnering with Democratic-leaning independent groups like Priorities USA, the Service Employees International Union, plans to spend $4 million on a Spanish-language advertising campaign in the swing states of Colorado, Florida, and Nevada. The group is also partnered with the League of Conservation Voters and the United Auto Workers. So essentially what's happened, in order to check this money that's being put into the election campaign by these Republican right-wing billionaires that want to destroy the unions and are already destroying the middle class, or sections of it. I mean, sometimes, you know, you and I go to places, and don't you get the feeling, you know, recession? What recession?
Yeah. Full of people having a good time, running up the tab.
Yeah. I was at a place, and I was thinking, maybe I won't have a beer. I'll just have a martini. It's all martinis, $10, except for this one that was $15.
Yeah, really?
Oh, man. I can't believe it. So here, these unions are forced into, as a defensive mechanism against the Republicans that want to destroy them, and are really forced to support the Democrats who don't do very much for them at all, and to spend, that's how they have to spend dues money. Rather than using it on more constructive things that would help the people that they represent and the entire working class. Because, as we've said so many times, that the unions, although certainly one could make any number of criticisms of them and how bureaucratic many of them have become, they are the only bulwark against the social forces, the right-wing social forces that want to send us back to the 1920s or the 1880s or something like that.
With zero protection for workers.
Zero protection. And no minimum wage. And no weekend. And no hours.
Yeah, no fighting for their rights on any level.
Yeah, exactly. And if and I wonder, I mean, I always wonder. You know what I don't? I think this is, I don't really wonder. I mean, when we talk about that, it's not like people call in and say, well, no, I don't. We don't need the unions because we have another protective medium or apparatus. Something else will protect us from the outrageous manner in which the capitalism treated its workers since its origins in the 18th century through to, say, like the 1930s in this country when they, you know, when working people actually were able to get enough protection through their unions and through the union pressure on the government to have a middle class life. I mean, that's what that's what built the middle class. So
the now dwindling.
Yeah. So here, a working class guy comes up to me today and says, "Sounds like the beginning of a joke."
Is this for real?
Yeah. Actually,
okay.
Yeah. I mean, he's a painter, and he, you know, he doesn't work for anybody. He works for himself. And
okay.
Those guys, you know, angry white man, to be sure. And he said, "Your boy Obama is going to put in this real estate tax that every piece of real estate sold in the United States is going to have a 7.9 tax on it, whether even if you're selling underwater property, a property that's worth less than the market value and all that." I said, "You know, man, that's wrong on the face of it." He's no, that's he says I got it from something
else,
probably. And I said, "That can't be for two reasons." I said, "When did this come about?" And he said, "Well, it was passed about a year ago." I said, "Yeah, and no one's heard about it, just
yeah,
you."
And we haven't. And we, who actually do this for a living and study and research just about everything, haven't heard one thing about it.
And a year,
amazing.
And a year ago, you got to remember, taxes, all spending bills, originated in the House, in the House Appropriations Committee, which is run by Republicans.
Right.
And they're not. And they're not about to do that. Well, I mean, I said, "Look, man. Go to Snopes.com. Put in Obama real estate tax and see what you get." And, of course, it was total BS. In fact, he had like...
Did he do it? He went...
I actually did it and gave it to him, and he kind of harumphed, you know. And actually, it said that most of it had been a 3.8 tax. And, I mean, that's absolutely not true. I mean, it says, if you go to it, it says true... How do they say it? There was a section that people with capital gains taxes over $250,000 selling property, they would have a 3.8% tax, which is good. I mean, that's good. But then I was, he made me think. I mean, he was just searching around for reasons.
In all of his anger?
In anger. Why could he vote against Barack Obama? I mean.
Did he vote for him before?
I don't know. I doubt it. But here, this says, according to this article in Reuters, a majority of independents, those are people that say they're neither Democrats nor Republicans, say that Obama's policies have made it harder for Americans to gain employment. 52% of independents said they agreed with the idea that the president has not helped create more jobs in America, an argument central to Romney's campaign.
Now these independents, are we talking the Tea Party?
No, I don't think so.
Somewhat, maybe?
No, I don't know. But here, there's two different things here. One is that his policies have made it harder for Americans to gain employment. That's one thing. And I would like someone to call us at 313-298-WRIF and tell us specifically
what
Obama policies, because he hasn't been able to get anything through.
Right. Exactly.
So that seems false on the face of it. So really what you have here are just sort of these clones that that hear these little phrases and then repeat them back. And I guess, and what it is, I think they're almost fearful to, you know, to say, well, I mean, it's sort of what they almost they call a push-pull. That is, you drive the answer. So, by your question. So, so I say to you, well, do you think Obama's policies have made it harder for Americans to gain employment? And you go, and there's this little, you know, pause there, and you don't want to seem like, what was that guy that was, remember the guy when they asked him about Syria? What was his name?
Oh, it was about Libya, and it was, like, how quickly we...
Isn't it nice, though, and he's going to be, he's a talk show.
The 999 guy.
999, yeah. You know, he's going, like
he was clueless.
He was clueless,
I mean, and it's, the funny thing is, I said, you know, I'm so much younger than this guy, and I have a lot less experience in the corporate world. I could have smoked that guy with that whole Libya
thing. So anyway,
thing.
I doubt whether any of these people could name the Obama policies that have made it harder for Americans to gain employment. But then it says a different thing in the next sentence. 52% of independents said they agreed with the idea that the president has not helped create more jobs in America, an argument central to Romney's campaign. Well, how could he do that again? Asking since the Republicans control legislation of that nature in the House, and the only way that the government can create jobs is to create jobs. That would be to have an increased stimulus package, much like Roosevelt had during the 1930s, or the kind of thing that the government did to bail out General Motors and what have you. So, I mean, this makes no sense whatsoever, but, I mean, we have a seriously low information populace, let alone voters. About 50 million people aren't even registered to vote. Let's see. What do I have? Obama appears to have trouble convincing some members of his own party that his administration has been good for jobs. 29% of Democrats said they agreed with the claim that he has not been a job creator. Again, I mean, that's a weird phrase. These Republicans make up these phrases.
Yeah, remember, stick. That's the scary thing.
Yeah, because here was the phrase job creators. I mean, it was two facets to it. One is job killer, and the other is job creator. And what the Republicans say is that regulations on businesses, particularly big corporations and financial institutions, are job killers.
They inhibit any job growth.
And that taxes on the ultra wealthy are job killers. So the Republican platform, the Romney campaign, the Republican campaign essentially is based around less taxes on the ultra wealthy. Because then the idea is they'll have more money to spend creating more jobs, which is absolute nonsense.
Yeah, that doesn't pan out.
It doesn't happen at all.
Mm-mm.
In fact, remember a guy named George W. Bush? you can imagine like the Republicans are standing around. So it's, it's George W. Bush. What are we? Hey, man, hi. Can you here? Let's take you in the. We want to talk to you in the back room here. The online poll also found that. Romney, a former Massachusetts governor, argues that the Obama administration's health care reform has been bad for the economy, a view that now resonates with a majority of people. Somebody please tell me how this program, which has not really even gone into full effect.
2014, people, and it's actually going to be going.
Romney says the first thing he's going to do is get rid of it, which includes things like, pre-existing conditions, the fact that that we can take young people under their parents' insurance up to the 25, lots of stuff like that. But, I mean, I guess you just say things enough times. So, and also, remember, Obamacare is identical to Romneycare.
Yes, because he created that when he was governor.
Yeah. The online poll found Americans split over the right course for government, with 51% of respondents saying they support dramatic cuts in government spending and 49% saying that increased infrastructure spending would improve the economy.
So half and half. And, I truly think people are just confused. I really do. And I think part of the confusion is what is, being spread, like you said, from the Republicans and especially Fox News.
Well, again, if you really look into some of these questions, they are sort of like apples
And oranges.
And oranges. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Because here, it said 51% of respondents saying they support dramatic cuts in government spending. I support that. Taking the $1 trillion
war budget
and cutting it in half.
Yeah. And the other number that I really like to throw out there, because it just simplifies it, is that 50% of your tax dollars, you, the listener, is going to the war budget. And
Unnecessarily.
Absolutely, Peter.
Yeah, there's no need for all these bases all around the world. There's no reason for all these exotic weapons. No one else is building them. Russia's not building them. China's not building them.
And we just keep building more and more and more and more.
Yeah. I mean, that's
bigger, better, faster, more, you know?
Well, it's a war economy. And 49% saying that increased infrastructure spending would improve the economy. Well, if the government, like it did, say, in the 1950s, building the interstate highway system, decided we were going to bring this country back to some sort of grandeur. So we had wonderful schools, great transportation systems.
Yeah, ours is pathetic. We have these old trains, and everywhere around the world, they have high speed, rail.
Yeah, these need to be government subsidized. They have how many ferries do they have across Lake Michigan? I think one.
Yeah.
They should have six.
I think there might be two now. There's the SS Badger and there might be two.
Yeah. I mean, a whole system. And what that would do, it would allocate the same amount. And I've always been a big advocate of not even beginning taxation on incomes till you hit 50,000. I mean, you need these really huge taxes on, these guys making $70-80 million a year. You know, they don't need to make all that. Let's see. Oh, yeah. But fortunately, so then Americans say Bush still more to blame than Obama for the economy.
There's a sensical headline.
More than two-thirds of Americans, including half of Republicans, still blame former President George W. Bush for the country's economic ills. I don't know. I mean, I wonder what people think that... here's another question.
But did that part of it just go away?
Yeah.
I don't get that.
Well, you know what? Here, too. Someone wrote in response to that, Bush was losing 750,000 jobs a month as he scurried back to Texas. Obama has turned it around. We have had 23 consecutive months of private sector job growth, 227,000 this month alone. Well, it hasn't been enough to do, to rectify the damage that Bush and the Republicans, Reaganomics, did.
He can't work miracles.
Yeah. And he can't work with these Republicans who want to destroy him. And destroy the Democratic Party,
which would take a miracle.
Yeah. What would?
For the Democrats to get the Republicans to anything.
Yeah. So, family net worth drops to the level of early 1990s. This is the end of Reaganomics, and these Romney and the rest of them, they want to go back to it. Well,
yeah,
okay.
So you want that. If you want that, I'd like to know why.
Yeah. And so what are the questions? What are the Obama policies that have, what did they say, that have not allowed job creation or that have killed jobs? Since, if there would have been, the job creation should have been for the government, from the government.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, what were the other questions that I asked? Yeah, how does the health care reform bill, how's that bad for the economy? What does that do now?
Yeah, how is it costing all of this money?
It's not costing, next to nothing. All right, some people have some
comments.
Comments. 313-298-WRIF is our number, and in numerals it is?
It is 313-298-9743.
All right, here's our first call. It's Michael from Fenton. Michael, hi, it's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how you guys doing? I didn't get into that, how Obama's policies, we didn't get no jobs because of them. But there's a bigger problem, and part of the problem on that one is the premise of that question. But there's something else going on right now with this this Catholic church thing with this abortion and insurance, that they're turning the Latino Catholics against Obama because of that issue, and they're going to pull up a bunch of them votes because of that, and that's a trick of the Republican Party. And there was another trick of the Republican Party, what they pulled on Obama when he came in, which he fell for, which is basically a mistake. And so, you know, he's not perfect. He's made mistakes, and this is a mistake that he made. He did the stimulus package, and he gave it to the banksters. And when he did that, he was supposed to give it to the people that voted him in and create jobs, thinking that he could trust them. And so he gave it to the Republicans, and now they're all laughing at him. He can't admit that, but that's what happened.
Well, you know, the bailout, of course, was the Bush administration began that, and Obama carried it on. I mean, I don't know whether that's true. At some point, I have this just gut feeling that I just wish they would have let him collapse. But it could have, in fact, created the collapse of the entire American economy.
Yeah.
We could be eating, you know, grass right now or something like that. I mean, it's you get to the point where the banksters run the entire system without regulation. I mean, that's Reaganomics. And then suddenly we're going to say, oh, no, sorry, you're out of here. We're not, you know, the government is just going to essentially not be your little toy anymore, your little instrument that means you can take any risk that you want. I mean, it was a long time coming, and it would take some doing to fix it so you don't have the banksters in control. And just to have allowed, you know, the banks all to fail, I think they really were too big to fail. What do you think, Michael?
I think they wouldn't have failed if you'd have gave the $880 billion or maybe even doubled that, run it through the poor people, put the money out there. They would have spent the money, bought cars. There wouldn't have been no banks failed. Maybe the banks that did fall would have been the ones that should have fell, you know, in that. And so, you know, there would have, that was, it's just all.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting concept.
Yeah,
I mean, we're both going,
Yeah, because people will spend the money. You're right.
That was not, as you can imagine, anywhere in anybody's cards, though. So, I think it really was either bail out the people that caused the problem. Imagine that. I mean, I'll bet you, you know, Michael, I bet you there's so many people that listening to this audience that have had small businesses go belly up, go bankrupt, including my father. And at one time in his business career, and everybody says it, nobody bailed him out. It's just, that's the market.
Right.
You know, the market makes the decision.
Yeah.
You know, except when you're the ultra wealthy and the government is your insurance.
It's your pal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Michael, thank you very much. Appreciate your call.
You know, it's like all these war criminals who've gone, like Rummy, Rumsfeld, and Cheney, and all of them, how they've committed these atrocities, yet they just keep climbing the financial ladder.
Crime pays in that
world.
313-298-WRIF. Here's Jim in Roseville. Hi, Jim. You're on the air. Welcome. Jim?
Yeah, hello.
Hey,
yeah.
Jim. You're on the air.
Hey, man. What are you guys, hippies or what, man?
Are we hippies? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. What else? What's your next question?
Are you?
No. Hell no.
You kind of sound like one.
No, I like it. I ain't no hippie.
Okay. We're hippies, and we don't get high.
Wait. Let's not spend too much time on our personal life, all right? So we're hippies, so what?
You're so smart and intelligent.
Yeah, thank you.
You really are. I mean, I listen to you, and I respect your opinions.
Thank you.
But you're so anti-Republican. How can you be that dumb?
Easily.
Wait a minute. Are you a millionaire, Jim?
Am I in the military? No.
No.
Are you a millionaire?
What's that?
Do you have a lot of money?
No, I'm very poor.
Why in the hell
are you supporting these fat cats and the corporations?
The Republicans are 100% for the rich and for the corporations and couldn't care less about a poor man from Roseville. What?
When I work, I feed myself.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
So do I.
I don't get a bridge card. I don't get
that. Oh,
okay.
I see.
So
this
it's
is
that
the
old
party.
Bridge card, the
it's
party
the party.
Store
it's
thing.
The party of resentment.
Oh, okay. I thought he was going to tell us a party store story.
Yeah.
The Republicans
support the bridge card just like the Democrats support their bridge card. And you know why, Jim? Because there's so many poor people in the state that people wouldn't have enough to eat. Don't worry. Your taxes aren't going for that.
Your taxes are going to kill people illegally overseas.
What?
I'd be mad. Why be angry? I'm not arguing. I'm trying to discuss with you.
Okay. We're not mad.
Well, give me a look.
Opposite side of what you're saying.
Okay. So you're putting down people. Wait a minute, Jim. You, wait a minute. Oh, that's. I'm so glad we have that little thing we can put. Let me ask you this. Are you putting down people who need assistance? You know, you're talking about women and children.
I never said it's bad to get. I said I don't get.
So what?
So what? Neither do I.
Why be mad? Why say so what?
Why say what?
So what?
So what?
Why say so what?
So what? So what?
Why say so, what? I don't
so
know.
What? Yeah,
just
so what?
What?
All right. Thanks.
I think that,
Jim.
Yeah,
so
thanks,
what?
Jim.
So what?
You know, there's an inner, what is it, Peter? You know, where deep down, I think he probably does kind of look down on people with bridge cards.
Well, you know, I think there is this sense among many people, which is less accurate than it used to be in earlier times, that nothing is going to change for the average man, and particularly the working man, and so that they just get off on this resentment, you know.
Yeah.
They should
resent the government and what they're doing, not people who can't afford to feed their children. People who are born into poverty, the majority of them don't get out of poverty. And there's no way that in this country that we can all have that, you know, success story. We can all climb out of poverty. We can all rise to the top and be this big athlete or whatever, as a lawyer, doctor, whatever. That's ridiculous.
Well, the real question here is why does the wealthiest country in the world have the highest percentage of poor people than any other industrial country in the world?
Yeah, good question.
I'll let you ponder that. We'll come back and talk more about this. And now, don't take this the wrong way, but HBO has apologized for putting George W. Bush's head on a stake.
I saw it.
Right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Detroit's Rock Station. On the web, thanks for listening to WRIF.com. Thanks for rocking with the riff online. This is WRIF.com.
this.
Huh. We're back.
Peter, what is going on?
Jade, we got to talk to you.
Oh, no. She's in trouble.
Yeah. What happens? There's something, it's called in the radio lingo, production.
Yeah.
And what that means is there are these recorded bumpers in and out of these advertising clusters. And actually, Jade was helping us greatly with the podcast.
With some other stuff.
And
but everything. Let's make sure we have those in for the rest of the show.
Yeah. Okay. We'll have to
let's
do
aim
that.
Higher.
Okay. One of the things that has all of the lines at 313-298-WRIF abuzz is that we were talking about this poll that was taken by Reuters and Ipsos that said that 52% of independents said they agreed with the idea that the president has not helped create more jobs in America. And I was wondering, how was he to do that when the Republicans control half of the Congress and are bound and determined not to pass any of his policies at all. Also, they said a majority of independents said Obama policies have made it harder for Americans to gain employment, and I was wondering what those were. And the other thing is that Romney argues that the Obama administration's health care reform has been bad for the economy, and I was asking how. And since Obamacare and Romneycare, the state program in Massachusetts, was identical, I don't get it.
Please explain.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. One thing too about we'll go somewhere voting, but we got an email. But I said we were going to talk about HBO putting George W. Bush's head on a stake. Now the vast majority of American people agree that George W. Bush is more to blame than Obama for the economy. 2/3 of Americans, including half of Republicans, still blame Bush for the country's economic ills, but putting his head on a stake, man, wow. But HBO has apologized for using a model head of former President George W. Bush in a grisly decapitation scene for its hit drama, Game of Thrones.
I was surprised that that even happened in the first place.
Well, what?
That they did that.
That they used it?
Yeah.
Well, the 10th episode of the first season of Game of Thrones, now out on DVD, features the younger Bush's head on a stake. His head appears in a couple of beheading scenes, and apparently what had happened is they need heads, right? So, I mean, where do you get heads? Well, they just had a lot of heads, and one of the heads they had was Bush's head. So they just clumped it down there on a stake.
Uh-oh.
The producers said we use a lot of prosthetic body parts on the show, heads, arms, etc. We can't afford to have these made all from scratch, especially in scenes where we need a lot of them, so we rent them in bulk.
And it says that it looked like him. I don't even know if it really was him.
Well, I have the screen grab in front of me. I don't even know. There's two of them there. I don't even see which it is.
Oh, it's the one. It's the first one. Yeah, you can tell.
The one at the bottom left?
Yeah. You can tell if you look with how he purses his lips and that.
Well, maybe you're right. After the scene was shot, someone pointed out that one of the heads looked a lot like George W. Bush. In the DVD commentary, we mentioned this, though we should not have. We meant no disrespect to the former president and apologize if anything we said or did suggested otherwise.
Oh, my.
But in terms of images, the Republicans are having a real bad time. You know, to a lot of conservative white people, they all look the same. You know that? Right?
Grumpy.
Yeah.
Gray and grumpy.
No. I mean, to the gray and grumpy people, all the other all looks the same.
Oh, yeah.
So the Latino vote is something that both the parties are really after, but they both have Spanish, the Republicans and Democrats both have Spanish language websites.
Go figure.
And a keen pair of eyes discovered a gaffe on one such Republican site. The top banner featured a group of children that weren't Latino, but Asian.
They got their colors mixed up.
Yeah,
they're racist.
They can't. They don't know the difference.
Yeah, you're right about that, Peter.
RNC, which is Republican National Committee, RNCLatino.com, mix-up was discovered by U.S. News and World Report when a reporter there realized the stock photo downloaded from Shutterstock included search terms such as Asia, Asian, interracial, Japanese, and Thailand. A strong sign the children in the photo weren't Hispanic.
Oh, my God.
I mean, these people. The site is run by the Republican National Committee, which has launched to have, quote, open communication about the goals and vision of the Republican Party with Latino voters. Strike three, MF.
See you later.
Don't you got an email there, and we'll get back to our phones?
Yeah, we're going to get back to the phones, but this is real quick. Hippie Brendan, you know, someone called to ask if we're hippies. He said, hey, man, I and many others was wondering what it would take for Hippie Brendan, otherwise known as Appleseed when he's not smoking, remember
right,
that part,
right.
Could be a guest on our show. He wants to be a guest on our show, Peter.
Just call in, man.
If not, I would love to have a meet and greet, man. He wants to do a meet and greet with us. Did you know I'm a musician and an aspiring actor? It would be great, man. Meet and greet. That would be funny.
Yeah.
Would anyone come?
We'll get back to you, Brendan. 313-298-WRIF. This is the Night Call Show. I'm Peter Werby with Jalene Jordan. Here is Nick in Grand Rapids. Nick, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air.
Hey, what's up, man? I was just looking
through
and I heard you.
Wait a minute.
Wait.
Are you on speakerphone? Because you sound, we can hardly hear you.
Oh, okay.
You got to pull it off of that.
Hopefully.
Yeah, you're better there.
Okay. I just heard you talking about Reaganomics.
Yeah.
And I think, and you asked to call in if you support it. Well, I mean, I think it can be just summed up in a question, you know. Have you ever known someone who works for a poor person? And the answer is no.
Wow, that's deep. Did you just think of that phrase? Wow. Man.
He's been thinking about that.
He stumped us.
How long has he been on hold?
He's a long time.
He's been thinking about it the whole time.
Have you ever gotten a job from a poor person?
Huh. Wow,
man. I'm changing all my views.
I mean, me too.
What an angel.
My gosh.
All right. Let's get this on the air.
People in their disdain for poverty.
Carrie's calling in from Rochester. I think this will be a little window of sanity. Carrie, welcome to the broadcast.
I hope so.
You're on the air.
Hi, I would love to be a window of sanity. That's fantastic.
Please do.
I'm actually calling from Rochester for the Green Living Festival and the Party for the Planet, which is this weekend.
Lovely.
And if it's okay with you, I'd just like to give your listeners a little bit of detail about it.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, this coming weekend.
Yes.
Yeah.
This coming weekend.
Right.
So,
go ahead.
Starting at Friday at 4 o'clock, and this goes all the way through till Sunday at 5. The hours are on the website, which I'll give you in a second.
But wait. We're talking about this Green Living Festival in Rochester, which is what? Give us the basic definition.
Well, what we're trying to do is celebrate all the successful efforts by businesses, individuals, and government groups working together to kind of make decisions based on what would be good for people, the planet, and for prosperity. So trying to make more sophisticated decisions, you know, with the environment in mind and the current health care crisis and preventive medicine and all of that.
Okay. Sounds good. So Friday, I know because I've been running some public service announcements for this that the list of events is pretty extensive. So, Carrie, I really need you kind of give just a few of the headline events and also the website, and we'll check it out that way.
Beautiful. Thank you. Okay, so Harvey Wasserman is the guy who said no nukes.
Is he going to be there?
He's our buddy.
Yes, he's going to be talking about Fukushima and that effect that it's having, you know, worldwide.
Wow, cool.
I know. And then Sunday at 11, we've got a partner with Motor City Bone Marrow. We're going to have a walk and run with Tara Revan. She's one of the survivors. We've got the smokehouse coming for the kids at the fire department. We've got two guys coming and talking about yardening, which is a new term meaning edible landscaping. Things you can do in your own yard for, you know, edible food.
Love it.
Sure, like tomatoes.
I know. Climbing Tower, we're having a food court. As far as headliners, I'll give you that information since you asked.
Wait a minute, Carrie. Well, I was going to say, you're talking to a WRIF audience, so you said, the magic word, party for the planet. So what's happening here?
Okay, that's going to be going on until 10 o'clock Friday night and Saturday night, and it's right there at the festival site, downtown Rochester. Friday night, our headliner is Kyle Vincent. I don't know if you know him, but Bay City Rollers. He was the lead singer on the last
show. Wow.
Yeah.
Fun.
And then Sunday, we're having Long Neck Strangler, who does, they do like a country and rock meld. They're yeah. really, that'll be Saturday night. I'm sorry. Kyle Vincent is Friday night. Long
Rockabilly.
Sunday will be Acoustic Brothers from Different Mothers, and they have a kind of like a comedy, music. There's a lot going on with their show. It's very visual. And then our headline presenters include Dr. Michael Greger, who's coming in from Washington, D.C. His specialties as an MD are bird flu, swine flu, and mad cow disease.
Ugh. Damn.
Yeah. But, Carrie, let's do this. Give us
the website.
Yeah, give us the website. We'll let people check it out because, I didn't mean to disparage our audience. I mean, obviously, we all like party and great music.
You were talking about hard rock versus something else.
So what's the website?
It's MIGLF.com, stands for Michigan Green Living Festival.
GLF, okay.
Yeah.
MIGLF.com.
Yeah. Well, good.
And actually, you can find us on Facebook, too. We have a huge website there, or web page there with a lot of prizes. If you like the page and send it on, you are entered in the drawing.
Well, can we, Jalene, can we link that from?
We like prizes. I'll look it up. Is it under Michigan Green Living?
Yeah.
Yes, Green Living Festival, and it's Michigan Green Team is the background. Michigan Green Team.
Okay, great.
Well, thank you for
Thanks
all the
a
information.
Lot. I hope it goes really well.
Appreciate it. So there are positive, good things going on. I mean,
in the city. We got an email from Jerry Van who said, some people are obvious victims of social engineering when they barely have two nickels to rub together and look down on those with less. I couldn't agree
there
more.
You. Well, yeah, and we are addressing some of these questions, and I'm curious, as I said, here was the quote. A majority of independents said that Obama's policies have made it harder for Americans to gain employment, which I was saying, could you name a couple? And also, 52% of independents said the idea the president has not helped create more jobs. How would he have done that with the Republicans controlling the House? And what should he have done that he is not doing? I bet you can't come up with anything.
I'd like to hear it. Yeah. We'd like to hear it.
Yeah. Okay. wait, we got to get this on. Here's Kathleen in Westland. Kathleen, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, how you doing?
We're doing good.
Hi, Kathleen.
The guy who said, have you ever gotten a job from a poor person?
Yeah.
As a painter, I have a real job now.
Yeah.
But I've painted for, well over 20 years.
Painting's a real job.
Wait. You mean painting walls or painting on canvas?
Painting walls.
Okay.
Well, there was a lady. She lived over in Angster. She really needed her house painted. She didn't have the money. I put her on a payment plan. It took her over a year to pay me. But,
So you worked for someone who didn't have much money. So there you go.
That is a wonderful story. I mean, it shows you've got a heart. But you know also that the caller was just repeating this stupid little saying that when people criticize the wealthy of hogging all the resources and all the wealth of this country and making us a country with the largest number and the largest percentage of poor people in the industrial world, they say, well, no poor person ever gave me a job,
Well, you know what? I know a lot of people, they might be making $70,000 a year.
Yeah.
But they're working from paycheck to paycheck.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and so how it goes usually, the more you make, the more you spend, and your debt just stays kind of the same.
It does.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks for the story. Thanks for the story, Kathleen.
Thank you.
Appreciate it, Kathleen. All right. Bye now. Okay, 313-298-WRIF. Some phone lines opening up. Here's Paul in Sterling Heights. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Jalene.
Hi.
Hi, Paul.
I was going to talk about messaging. You were talking about job creators. And when they put me on hold, Jalene said my favorite two words in the world.
I did?
What's that?
Fat cats.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Why use job creator when you can use the word fat cat?
I guess.
Okay, here's the deal. People tell me that I'm a socialist. My message is I'm just a socialist as the National Football League.
How do you, okay, we'll bite on that one. How do you, what do you mean?
32 teams divide all the television revenue up equally.
Uh-oh.
Okay? And 49% of that television income goes to their players.
Yeah.
Is that socialism?
Sounds like it.
Okay, there's another one.
What's that, Paul?
People tell me because I'm union, I'm what ruined Detroit.
Oh, God.
And the way I explain it is, if you expect me to accept the same payment as a Chinese auto worker making $25 a day, fine. I'll do it if you accept the same wages that a Chinese worker makes doing your job.
Yeah, there you go.
Hey, right on.
Yeah.
Right on. Yeah.
No, but it's got to be about a message. You and I are both liberals, and explaining doesn't make it. If you can make it into a bumper sticker, boy, does that ever work.
All right, Paul.
Well, Paul, we've got you back.
Thank you very much. We'll do more of this when we come back. I didn't realize, if someone would have said to me, how much is a pack of cigarettes these days? Mm-hmm. Do you know how much?
Yeah.
How much?
It's like $7 or something.
Okay. You know how much it is in New York City?
Oh, it's, I can tell you probably. I have a friend who lives there who smokes, yeah.
Unbelievable. Ah, we'll be right back. And that and more of your calls. We want to talk more about what policies I have Barack Obama begun that have stopped job creation or killed jobs. I don't get this. I don't get this any. Maybe you've got an idea. Let us know.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
This is 101 WRIF. Thanks for rocking with us online at WRIF.com.
Do you like what you see when you look in the mirror? If not, maybe it's time to make some changes. Here's Dr. Michael Gray of the Michigan Cosmetic Surgery Center and Skin Deep Spa.
Enhancing the natural beauty of your appearance brings with it tremendous boosts in self-confidence. You don't have to get undressed in the dark. I can provide you the body that you've always dreamed of. Let your mirror reveal your true inner self.
That's what we'd all like. But Dr. Gray, how does a person know where to start?
Well, first we have to figure out what it is that bothers you that's making you feel not confident about yourself. Once we can figure that out, I'll give you options. We'll sit down and review what your choices are so we can create a new you together.
So, ladies, if you're ready to get the look you've always wanted and boost your self-confidence, call Dr. Michael Gray of the Michigan Cosmetic Surgery Center and Skin Deep Spa for a complimentary consultation at 248-538-3333 or visit anewyou.com.
Don't settle for less than you deserve. Take the first step toward living the life you've always imagined and look as good as you feel. I'm Dr. Michael Gray. Call me today, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Everything that rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com.
What's your name?
Yard Bash. Learn more online now at WRIF.com.
I want to hear some revolution out there, brother. I want to hear that revolution. Brothers and sisters, it's time to testify. I want to know, are you ready to testify? Are you ready? I give you.
Peter and Jalene, you're listening to Night Call, the RIF award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And we are talking about this poll. It's very strange that these independents say, a majority of them say, the Obama policies have made it harder for Americans to gain employment. And I've been asking, without a single person saying how, that is the case. How have, and what are the Obama policies that have made it harder?
You know, I think it's so easy for people to make these blanket statements, but backing it up is a whole other story.
It's like they get a little sound bite from these ads. Yeah. I mean, why do these guys spend hundreds of millions of dollars on it?
That's why.
We're also talking about that in this poll, it said that 51% of Americans say they support drastic cuts in government spending. And generally that would mean, like this guy Jim that called from Roseville, mm-hmm. that was talking about people on bridge cards. And the people mostly are children and
women.
Mothers of the children.
Yeah. Right. And you want these kids to starve?
I was in a gas station, and a guy drove in a Cadillac and had a, I said, what were you?
What did they say after that?
I don't know.
They drove in a cat. Oh, he just had a Cadillac and was using a bridge card.
He was using a bridge card and he was buying cigarettes and, stuff like that.
Yeah, I was just telling this story the other day.
And I'm always struck by how many suburban white guys wind up in inner city and see the same sight.
They're cruising the hood. They're right down there.
Maybe it's this one guy, this one scamster that's got a Cadillac. Yeah, and somehow is able to, I don't know.
Yeah, he's got a hook
up. It's a little suspicious.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, one of the things in terms of spending, let me see, who sent this? To calltalkyes@yahoo.com. It's Brian. And it's photographs, essentially. It says, yet another way our government could put people back to work. And it shows these, are you looking at this? These incredible trains, these modern 21st
I've seen
century.
That one.
Germany, Russia, China, Japan, France, and then the United States. Hello, 1940s.
Yeah.
The others are like space age, 250 miles an hour,
I've been on one. I went on it's called the Talis high speed train. Thalys is how it's spelled. It went from Amsterdam to Paris and back slick. It was awesome.
How fast was it going?
I don't know.
I think those things go like 250.
It was the high speed one for sure.
And I don't want to go with
250. Peter, and I did, it was backwards even. And I.
What do you mean backwards? Oh, you were sitting backwards.
Going backwards all the way and all the way back, which at first I was like, damn, how do you get this switched around? But they just kept feeding us and bringing us stuff to drink, and it was fabulous.
And the slogan on this is put Americans back to work and improve our economy at the same time, rebuild our antique
infrastructure.
So, see, this is what we're left with, folks. I mean, no jobs, not like there used to be. And increasingly, the infrastructure begins to deteriorate. But when you look at the people that are really benefiting with things as they currently are constituted, remember, the conservatives are people that want to conserve things as they currently are. the wealthy, you know, the upper, say, 20%, maybe the upper third, probably the upper third of this country, just as, you know, everything swell. You know, new cars, and when they got to travel, mm-hmm. they can, you know, they get first class and what have you. So they don't care that
They're unaffected.
Yeah, this really does not affect them whatsoever.
Right.
All right, let's go back to our phone, 313-298-WRIF. Here is Fred in Detroit. Fred, you've been waiting patiently. Thank you. Hi, you're on the air.
Morning, Peter and Jolene. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes, hello. Welcome.
Okay, I guess I'll start with your last remark. And I happen to hear, was it Marco Rubio?
Yeah, from...
his mother was on Medicaid or Medicare.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, it's probably good for her, but not good for me.
Well,
so I'm
good,
sure if he had a chance to limit it to me, he would. Now, going all the way, you know, because they're talking about him with regard to being Mitt's running mate.
Yeah, let me just tell people he's the senator from Florida.
From Florida, yeah.
Yeah, and he is Hispanic, Cuban, right.
Now, as far as your first, I guess your first item when you started the night, you mentioned, you know, our political... I don't know, debates or year-long thing. Or
how the election, how long the election goes on.
Right, the election year. Well, in France, I think theirs is like limited to a few weeks, and it cuts down on the money, the media sensationalism, and wasted ad dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we couldn't do it, because it'd be too much like France.
Well, you're probably right there. And, you know, I don't know how this ever got so out of control. I mean, one of the way, of course, there's always big money in politics for the last, I don't know what, maybe even 100 years. But, with this, Supreme Court decision of Citizens United, that really has, you know, opened the floodgates for money to just be determinant, usually. It turns out almost to be a wash. I mean, both sides wind up to have, you know, I don't know what they're going to wind up with, $250 million or $500, half a billion dollars. I mean, this is insane, absolutely insane. All right, Fred, thank you very much.
Thanks, Fred.
Appreciate it. Always a pleasure talking to you. Now, do you have that story that I just held?
I don't have it in front of me, but I can tell you what it is about. But,
and because we have a caller.
And we had to talk about this. I
forgot all about it.
Yeah, well, I didn't forget about it, but we've just been on other subjects. But basically, the House Republican
in Michigan
refused to let these two female
legislators.
Yes, thank you, Peter, for finishing my sentence, from saying the word vagina.
Yeah, one of them said the word vagina.
Yes,
said something about what, you know, these right wing Republicans were trying to, you know, do more damage to a woman's right to choose, and I think, well, you know what?
Should she have just said, hey, my
My popo, yeah. But here's Joni from Farmington. Joni, hi, you're on the air. I hope you can do a better job of explaining this than we are.
Yeah.
Joni. Oh, you need to turn your radio all the way off.
I think we're going to just give, because we want to get her on. Yeah. Joni, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
There you are. Hi.
Okay, go ahead, Joni. You're on the air. Tell us the deal. We were trying to do it, and we didn't do a good job. What's up?
Well, it was really cute because your screener asked what I wanted to talk about.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So I said, vagina.
John, welcome to the job.
Yeah.
And he said, well, I don't know if you can talk about that, but I'll put something down.
Well, yeah.
Well, this sounds...
I just want to say it again. Vagina!
Thank you! My gosh, you know, like, women have them and men were popped out of them. Hello?
Joni, here, I got to tell you this, though. We have a screen, in fact, a little program called Assistant Producer, and it shows your name, your first name, where you're calling from, and also comments. So it says, Joni Farmington, gathering in Lansing tomorrow. She kept saying vaginas.
Did he spell it correctly? That would give me hope.
I don't know how to spell it. No, I know how to spell it. Yeah, it's spelled right. But wait a minute. People might not know what we're talking about. People are listening from all around the country, some from around the world. So tell us what the deal is. We're talking here about these Michigan state representatives or senators.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Lisa Brown, representative, and, well, she started the whole deal by innocently saying the word vagina on the floor of the House of Representatives, and she was censured and forbidden to speak the following day, which was the last day of the whole legislature meeting. Mm. I don't want to get bogged down in the details, and, you know, you can catch up online, but Eve Ensler, who is the playwright of the vagina monologue,
mm-hmm.
also a Tony Warning, a Tony Award-winning playwright, will be at the Lansing State Capitol tomorrow on the steps.
Come on!
Really?
Helping to perform the vagina monologue with at least eight other state representatives.
What time is that?
A gathering's going to start at 5 o'clock. It should be a good time.
Wow. That is so great.
The show starts at 6 o'clock. We've got to get out there. If you can't make it, you know, in body, make it in spirit. It's just incredible.
This is, yeah, absolutely incredible.
It's created quite a firestorm, not just in Michigan.
Yeah, yeah, it turned out to be.
Oh, clearly.
You know, I'm as frustrated as you. There was I don't even know what to do anymore. I don't know whether to laugh or to cry.
I know.
You know, we're talking about contraceptive rights. Now, you know, abortion is legal in the land. These Republicans, these whack jobs that we elect to office, and be there or be square. Okay.
Right on.
All right, Joni.
Message back.
You know,
I'm going to try to make that.
Yeah.
Totally unacceptable.
Hey,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
Joni,
ACLU says if you can't say it, you can't legislate it, okay?
Right, yeah. Go. Stay out of it.
Hey, Joni.
Not
Joni,
to yell.
Joni, if you can email us, we'll put this up on our
Facebook and
yeah.
Peter can put it on his...
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure the word was spread really, you know, quickly, and I think it is on Facebook already.
It is.
Okay.
But in terms of just a great place to be for some good vibes going down, you know, in a way, this is a real opportunity because the world is going to see what we're going to have to deal with here. These doofuses.
Yeah, it's true.
I mean,
and you're being nice.
Yeah,
I'm trying to be nice. I have other words, too, in my vocabulary, and they're all acceptable.
Yeah, yeah.
Forward. So here's the deal, folks. A state representative, a woman, was censured by the Republican leadership of the Michigan House of Representatives for saying the word vagina on the floor of the House. She was forbidden to speak.
When talking about contraception.
About talking about contraception and abortion.
Right.
And Joni from Farmington is talking to us about this gathering, which will be in Lansing on it's 12-12. So you're talking about Monday, right? Monday.
That's right.
Monday, 5 p.m. on the steps of the Capitol in Lansing. I'm leaving town real early in the morning, or I'd be there for sure.
Oh, yeah, you are. I'm going to try to make it up.
I'm going to be square.
I'll totally try to
make
it.
Yeah, I am.
All right, all right, all right. We'll do it. Joni, thank you so much. Thanks for that
information. If you know what I look like, make sure you...
Yeah, go to our Facebook page. Go to Facebook.
Blonde and short.
Facebook.com/nightcall.
Nightcall.
Facebook.com/nightcall. You're short. Yeah, women are getting taller. Wasn't I talking last week about all these 6 foot to 6 foot five women down at this Bravo event?
I don't think I remember you talking about that part.
Wow. Anyway,
yeah, you're just so used to being around me.
Here's, though, did you see this? There was an interruption while President Obama was making a statement about immigration policy this Friday.
I did see this. Yeah, it was a reporter.
It was a reporter from this right-wing, let's not even say what it is, right-wing website. Stunning White House correspondent and television viewers. It clearly surprised President Obama as well. This guy just repeatedly raised his voice and tried to interrupt. Excuse me, sir, Mr. Obama said when Mr. Monroe finally spoke up. The man's name was...
Or initially spoke up, not finally.
Initially
he couldn't shut up.
He put his hand in the air and raised a finger as to say, wait, it's not time for questions, sir. And he had only been speaking for 5 minutes.
Yeah, and he said, not while I'm speaking.
Yeah. A few minutes later, Mr. Obama referenced the incident by saying, and the answer to your question, sir, and the next time I'd prefer you to let me finish my statements before you ask that question, is this is the right thing to do for the American people. He then apparently interrupted again.
Yeah.
So by shouting out and repeatedly interrupting the president during a speech, Mr. Monroe violated decorum at the White House and generated online shouts of disapproval from other reporters, analysts, and historians Hold on, let me turn
this guy
the page
is absolutely disrespectful.
Yeah. Another, now, on one hand, I don't put a great amount of stock in politicians, you know,
sure.
like they're like royalty or something
right.
like that. But when you start piling up these incidents, like this Representative Joe Wilson, during a State of the Union speech, shouted out, "You lie,"
oh, man.
While that President Obama was addressing Congress.
Well, he apologized, Peter,
yeah,
remember?
Or that awful right-wing governor from Arizona who was shaking her finger in the face of the president.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not making anybody, you know, like they're like some royalty or godlike figure or something
right.
like that. You know, that they should all be like dog catchers, respected, doing, you know, administrative jobs.
What do you mean dog catchers?
Well, I mean, everybody sort of at the, you know, that's sort of like the lowest level of political state administration
oh.
of human affairs.
Oh, okay.
And, you know.
I didn't get it.
And, yeah. So, but it's pretty, there's two things going on here, or both. It's because it's a black president.
Right.
I mean, no one's ever done, no one would ever do that to George Bush, interrupt him like
no.
that. No one.
Can you imagine
would
someone doing that to Ronald Reagan?
Shaking their finger in Ronald Reagan's face.
Yeah, but these people have no respect.
Or yelling out. Or it is just the kind of mentality, it's either or, that took place in this country in the years leading up to the Civil War, when there was actually physical assaults in Congress. You know, again, the pro-slavery people, you know, the ancestors of President day conservatives,
right.
even though I know they were, you know,
there were Democrats that were pre-racist,
but they were the conservatives. They wanted to conserve slavery. And so the Republicans have, with their rhetoric, so poisoned the well of political discourse. I mean, here is this this president who is this centrist or the center-rightist even, who has in many ways done nothing, certainly nothing wrong, that he is pillared as being the most extravagant and exaggerated denunciations, you know, that he's ruining the country.
All his overspending.
Yeah, and like that. And, you know, not a... And
he's a Muslim. He's a socialist.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Let's go back and get some more calls. Here's George in Canton. Hey, George. Hi. You're on the air.
Good evening. Kudos to you, Peter and Helene, for a great show.
Thank you.
A couple of rapid points. Too often, I think the Republicans and Romney are allowed to control the language of the debate.
Yep.
Sometimes language is so important. Examples, real quick. The ending the Bush tax cuts. They call it raising taxes. No, when you have a sale in a store and you put the price back to where it was after the sale, that's restoring something. That's not raising.
Yeah.
So they shouldn't be allowed to get away with that language.
They get away with everything. Think about all the phrases, right to life, right to work,
yeah.
a special interest. I mean, they've created...
No child left behind.
They create these phrases that they have no meaning other than, I don't know.
Trying to redirect people.
Yeah.
In a
yeah.
sense.
So right. it sounds like if you support a woman's right to choose, you don't support life. But go ahead.
Yeah.
Go
you're
ahead.
A murderer.
Sorry, George. Go ahead.
Another example, it wasn't pinned down to one word, but they're trying to get away with acting like this is just another regular kind of recession that Obama's had to deal with. I've lived through some. I've never seen one like this.
No, it's the worst.
Yeah.
So they can't be allowed to get away with this is just another one that should have been recovered by now.
Well, the other thing, of course, George, if you're an observer of this, you probably agree that this is the results of the kind of economic policies that conservatives want. They've destroyed the economy, except for the ultra-wealthy. So, I mean, what they've done is significantly injured the middle class. I mean, there wasn't a middle class until of any sorts until the New Deal, when everything that the conservatives tried to stop, everything from the minimum wage to Social Security and on into the 60s, Medicare and all that, all of which conservatives opposed, the opposite is Reaganomics. And this is what they're about now. They want to tear all of this down. They want to turn our fortunes, which would mean turn our fortunes over to them, over to the market, of which they control.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, privatizing everything.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate that observation, indeed. And let's see. Here, Dave is in East Point. Go ahead. You're on the air. Hey, Dave. You're
on the
air.
Dave, can you turn your radio off?
All right. We are going to put Dave back on.
But we'll be back.
Yep. We will be back.
Just listen through the phone and not the radio.
Right. Here is here's Roger in Dearborn. Roger, hi. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, hey, how you doing? First off, I love you guys. It's awesome.
Well, thank you.
Thanks. It enlightens me and educates me every time I listen to you. So.
Well, we're glad you're here.
Appreciate it.
Well, I got two things. And the first I just kind of want to mention is my thoughts on, you know, the country in general. And the fact that it's more systemic, you know, I don't think it's really Obama, Democrats, Republicans. I think it's the country in general in a systemic level.
Sure.
Issue.
I agree.
That, you know, it sounds kind of crazy, but my thoughts are if we could cap some of the income or what people are planning to do as presidents or congressmen and say, I bet you could find a ton of people out there willing to devote their life, like when our country was started.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to working for the government, for the betterment of the people, I think we'd find a ton of people out there. And we'd find people out there that would do the right thing. And the fact that they're all skewed with the thoughts of dollars here and dollars there for themselves or, you know, whatever is an issue. And, you know, when they're done with their presidency or whatever, even, you know, whether it's Clinton's $6 million a speech or whatever, if you cap that, you'd find some really true value people.
Well, you know, there used to be, there was a book called Everything I Know I Learned in Kindergarten.
Yeah.
And the thing, one of the things was that, you know, you can't bring candy unless you can share it with everyone. And the sharing is getting less and less. I mean, that,
now they're taking.
Yeah. So the inequality of income, you know, the vast fortunes that are being amassed by people that can't even use it, that don't spend it, that don't, you know, they just have huge amounts of wealth that they simply hoard, which it has no social or economic energy to it whatsoever. They don't create jobs. They don't even really invest it often. It's just sort of parked there. And it almost becomes so like you know, an ego gratification thing. I make $69 million a year, like the head of CBS. Like, you know, there's nothing anyone can do with that amount of money. What's his name? Moonves?
Les Moonves. And
yeah.
I mean, that's chump change compared to a lot of these cats.
Well, yeah, but think about if he would say, "I'm only going to make $5 million a year,"
yeah,
that they could take the other $64 million and field a, you know, make CBS again a paragon of news. An investigation. Let people know what's happening in the world rather than just
reality show after reality show.
Absolutely.
On this note, kind of goes along with this. Bonnie from Pennsylvania wrote
in. Roger, thank you very
much. Roger, thanks.
Appreciate it.
Sorry.
Yeah.
She said poor people spend all their money on basic needs. So yes, they do create jobs by their meeting demands for food, shelter, clothing, etc. They create retail jobs, landlords, used car salesmen, auto repairs, etc. And teachers who teach their kids. And poor folks also pay sales taxes, gas taxes, and payroll taxes.
Sure.
She said capitalists don't create jobs. They create profit and avoid hiring people unless it is absolutely necessary.
There you go. Hey, you know, we never told people, I said we were going to tell people what a pack of cigarettes costs in New York City. $15.
Yeah, yeah.
$15.
I know. That's outrageous.
Yeah, that's incredible. Let's see. Here is Eileen in Port Huron. Hi, Eileen. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello. How are you guys doing tonight?
We're good.
Hello.
I just wanted to make a comment on talking about the bridge cards and how you see the guy at the Cadillac with the gas at the gas.
Well, we didn't. We don't.
We think white guys make this up because we've heard the same story in identical terms.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's my mistake then.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's one of the big problems with the economy being the state that it's in is people, you know, there's not a whole lot of jobs, but I don't think there's enough people who go out and look for jobs because I'm 20 years old, and every time I go out to look for a job, I get one. You know what I mean?
No.
Why do you think that? Why do you think you get the job? Maybe you're more qualified than some people.
What kind of job are you getting?
Wait, what kind of job do you do?
Well, I worked as a housekeeper in a hotel, and I'm also a hostess at a restaurant.
Okay, well, I mean, why do you think you get the jobs? Do you think because you're qualified?
Oh, it doesn't really take a whole lot of qualifications to be a housekeeper.
No. Well, you know, one of the things you, I don't think you can do, Eileen, is extrapolate. I mean, the sort of the suggestion that you're making that these tens of millions
people,
of people...
They're all lazy, poor people. Well, that's what you're saying.
Or the middle class. Think about all the middle class people that have lost their jobs and people that have been looking... Don't you see these things on television where people have been looking for a year and a half?
Well, I'm talking more about the people who make a lifestyle out of living off of benefits than...
Who do you know?
Do you know people? Or?
I mean, you know, it's too anecdotal. You know, you can't. I mean, let me say this. To the extent that there are people that are so deeply mired in poverty because they... And, you know, there's able-bodied men. That's out of the question. There's no able-bodied men doing that. But women with children, with, you know, poor women with poor children... you know, that wouldn't even be able to eat if they didn't have state assistance. The question is, why is there so many people that are mired in that category to begin with in a country that's the wealthiest country in the world? And one of our callers up there used the word systemic. In other words, it's structural. You have poverty, great amounts of poverty built in. Half the population of the United States is either poor or near poor. I mean, half the country, you know, and then you go, whoa. I mean, that's pretty desperate. I mean, could individuals, single individuals, perhaps find a job out of perseverance? Sure. In the middle of the Depression in the 1930s, people found jobs. And you know what people said? Anybody can find a job if they really... wanted one.
Not true.
But, yeah. And, you know.
It's not, absolutely not true.
And one of the things people may say that sometimes what they call the habits of poor people are responsible for their not being able to either get a job or to elevate themselves. Usually those qualities or those characteristics are characteristics of poor people, and they are all over the world. And one of them is this feeling of defeat, that because we have a caste system, the majority of
just
people,
like in India.
Yeah, the majority of people that are born real poor are going to stay real poor. The majority of people that are born real rich are going to stay real rich.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, kids.
You don't go outside of that usually. It happens, but
on
it's
both
rare.
Sides of it, you know, there's some working class and lower middle class people that get into the upper middle class, maybe even a small percentage of them that get into the upper class. But in the main, the reason we see these disparities of wealth and poverty isn't anything to do with personal habits or education or anything
or
like
lack,
that.
Yeah, lack of motivation.
It's all just in the way the system is set up to benefit some people and screw others. All right, Eileen, keep on looking for those jobs.
Lucky you.
Yeah, right. Let's see here. Wow, Tanya, hi. Tanya has a good idea. Tanya's from Taylor. She's on the air. Welcome. What's up?
Hi. I'm just calling about a response from the hippie Brendan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I listen to your guys' show, and I have total respect for you guys, but I think it's just so hilarious when that guy calls in. It just lightens the mood of things.
I wish he'd call in, yeah.
Brendan, give a call. It's not as fun when I read your emails. I think that's what she's saying.
Yeah, I think that if you guys did a meet and greet, that would be hilarious.
That's what
would you Brendan go? Would you come meet us?
And greet with Brendan, the hippie?
Would I come meet
him? Yeah. Wait a minute, you just want us to do it?
I just think that it's hilarious when he interacts with you guys.
I do too. But you know what?
I think this is one of hippie Brendan's friends.
we got an email from hippie Brendan who said that the Brendan that was, you know, Brendan kind of talks like, who was it?
Cheech or Chong.
Yeah. Hey, man. You know, I can't even do it. I got to get, hey, man. You know.
I think it's more Chong.
Yeah. And then, but then this guy called in and he's talked like this. He said, I've gone through recovery and I'm Brendan.
Now
the
he's
hippie.
Appleseed.
Appleseed. And and so Brendan the hippie wrote in and said this guy was an imposter. So,
yeah.
So we don't know.
we have our characters on the
we
show.
We don't know what to think. But we will take that into consideration.
Yeah, we'll think about that.
All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. I want to take this one. We probably should go let's take it.
Okay.
Here's Eric in Roseville. Hi, Eric. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, many years ago, my best friend had a true point. He said the purpose of the welfare state basically is to keep
certain large segment of our society peaceful, calm, and basically his final words were not rioting. And my immediate response to that was bullets are way cheaper. And
Do you always come up with ugly remarks like that?
Wow.
No, but it's true. And I want to know.
Wait.
So in other words, what he's saying, folks, is that like the 19th century.
Might as well just let them kill each other?
No. When the rabble gets out of hand, you just have the National Guard come and shoot them down like dogs? Like the cops and the Pinkertons and the National Guard to support the right of people that were that got out of hand, right?
Since you brought that up that way, in the 67 riots, they lasted 2 weeks in Detroit. In Atlanta, Georgia, they lasted 6 hours because the governor said, you will not shoot down my state troopers.
Wait a minute. Nobody shot down any state troopers. The Detroit police and the Michigan National Guard killed 42 people. It was one of the highest totals. It ought to be. You know, what is motivating you, man? I mean, what are you talking about? You know, it says here, I don't know. It says Peter doesn't know what conservatives are. Well, I know what conservatives are. Conservatives want to conserve things as they are.
Like the little things like back in the day, like racism, stuff like that.
Or let's even move.
Are we going to modernize it?
No. Conservatives wanted us to remain part of Great Britain. Conservatives wanted to retain slavery. Conservatives didn't want women to vote. On and on, right?
No, conservatives in the...
Wait, no. Who were the Tories? They were the conservatives. The other people were the revolutionaries.
I'm a conservative, and what I want to conserve is, I want to conserve the very premise of this country, which is individualism. I exist for those I choose to exist for.
Well, isn't Ayn
so
Rand just...
is that Ayn Rand's got
Yeah,
him?
That's Ayn Rand's. It's just what a load
like
of crap.
You don't care about anyone but yourself. And
I want to know. I would like to ask a question.
Well, I want you to answer my question. When did the conservatives, right, supported this country remaining part of Great Britain? True or not?
That's nonsense. You can change the meaning of your terms every other day.
No.
What?
There is a conservative trend. The conservatives are the ones that supported the police shooting down union people in the streets all over this country from the 1880s through the 1930s. So finally, they got the unions got the right to organize. Conservatives, were opposed to Medicare. Conservatives were opposed to Social Security. Conservatives were opposed to the minimum wage, right?
The legitimate function of government is...
Wait, how come you never answer my question?
Are you reading from some kind of Ayn Rand manifesto right now?
I don't have to read nothing to deal with the nonsense you spout.
Wait. How come you won't answer a question? Weren't conservatives opposed to every single thing that I said?
I'm telling you, a conservative says, when you're talking about shooting down union people or whatever, if those union people are destroying other people...
No, they weren't destroying
things. They weren't destroying anything.
Why don't you go read a little? Go read here. 1938, the Republic Steel Strike in Chicago. This was a family picnic in the Chicago... And they were striking. The striker, they were the United States steelworkers. They had their family. They had their kids. And the Chicago cops opened fire on them and killed, I forgot how many workers, shot, most of them all shot in the back as they were running in panic. And this is the kind of, what you're talking about, bullets being cheaper. I'll tell you, pal, I really got to do something. Your kind of ugly view of people and of the world are really what's wrong with everything.
Angry white
man. You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Detroit's rock station rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com. Detroit's rock station, on the web. Thanks for listening to WRIF.com.
I'm
Thanks for rocking with the Riff online. This is WRIF.com.
More Night Call on
101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome to our final segment at 1 a.m. Coming right up, a couple of interesting interviews, one about the recent recall election in Wisconsin, and the other about the drug war. Drug war.
Ooh.
Man, I can't even drive on drugs.
Oh, Peter.
That's the whole thing. Oh, let's do our armed madhouse report. Four people, including two ethnic Hmong shamans, were killed in a gang-related shooting in California's capital of Sacramento last Sunday. The dead included the gunman. A fifth person was hospitalized in critical but stable condition with gun wounds. The Sacramento Bee said the two shamans, traditional spiritual healers or guides, were in their 50s. Let's get everybody a gun.
Yeah, more than one. Everyone should have, like, five.
There was this guy, a suburban man from Birmingham, a suburb of Detroit. He's recovering after shooting himself through the crotch while adjusting his .40 caliber Glock.
Wow.
Yeah. Deputy Chief Mark Clements said, you think about it. Your femoral artery runs down there. He could have shut it off. It could. I don't know what the it is, whether it's the artery or it.
Yeah, it.
It could have been a lot worse. It's a big bullet. You're not talking about a small bullet. The victim was starting a job with an air conditioning company when the incident occurred. Well, that makes perfect sense.
What?
He underwent surgery, but there still might be injury to add to the insult. Though the man does have a permit to carry the gun, Clement said local prosecutors will decide whether to charge the man with reckless discharge of a firearm. I think they ought to let him slide. Don't you? I mean, yeah, it's kind of punishment. Okay. Wow, man. Let's see here. I'm just kind of looking at all these, laughing at all these things here.
Okay.
Here is Mike. Mike's over in Jackson. Mike, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. Bill Clinton recently contradicted his fellow Democrat up for re-election, President Obama, Bill Clinton, stating that Mitt Romney had a sterling business career, was a good businessman, and Bill Clinton also recently stated that the Bush-era tax cuts should be extended.
Well, Bill Clinton was a good Republican. Hello?
Now, he's the guy... The Republicans and Bill were responsible in many ways for the final nail in the coffin of the American economy by the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act that didn't allow the banks to do everything that they did. The Republicans put it forth, and Bill said, sure, I'm going to sign it.
Yeah.
So I'm not, I mean, the fact that...
The FCC, the fact that, opening up the FCC, so many things.
Yeah, so Bill Clinton wants to say that this, you know, this corporate raider, you know, Bain Capital and Romney were sterling business. I don't know what his sense of business is. Huh? Okay. Thank you. Appreciate that. Maybe we'll go through this. Let's see. Where are we here? We are right here. Here's Matt in Michigan. Hi, Matt. We're all in Michigan. Where are you?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah,
I can hear you.
I'm kind of curious on how poor people create jobs.
Oh, no, I don't think they really create jobs. I think what Kathleen was saying is that, and this is not a way. I mean, we are, you know, it's just like the lords under feudalism. They created it was their social system, and the peasants had to work under the terms that the lords decided. Well, we decided to get rid of feudalism, but we're kind of getting it back with the way things are going now. So the fact that the rich all run the show and the rich run it for themselves, well, sure, they are the ones that can create, you know, the definitions of the economy. But the fact that they are essentially looting the economy for their own aggrandizement, I mean, it's not even for their, you know, for wealth. They've got more money than they can ever possibly use. And I'm not talking about small business people. I mean, they've got a hard row to hoe, to be sure. But no, I think Kathleen was giving just sort of a little human anecdote, I would say. Hey, Julian?
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah.
All right, thank you very much.
Hey, let me put this on hold really quick.
Yeah, okay, go ahead. All right, we're there. All right, let me see. This is, how come this isn't working? Why? Okay, this is Chris from Sterling Heights. Chris, You are now, we have you faded down. No one can hear you. You said something to John, and if you say that on the air, you can say,
I don't even think you should put him on.
I'm going to put him on. I love
talking. Well, make sure that you have
those
papers
thing,
moved away from
yeah,
that
I do.
Button,
we,
please.
We have a button that doesn't get it on the air. So let me ask you this. Can you control yourself?
Blanking.
What?
Well, calm down. Blanking.
What?
Blanking, he said, instead of.
Oh, okay.
We appreciate that because.
Well, Leslie, are you a Republican or a Democrat?
What Neither. Do you think?
Neither. Certainly not a Republican.
Well, if you choose sides, you're on the wrong side immediately.
Well,
what?
Wait. He may be onto something. Go ahead. I mean, so you're saying that picking either the Democrats or the Republicans is a bad deal?
Both sides are in it for the same reason.
We're independents, by the way.
Yeah, but for the money.
Well, exactly. I mean, Bush started a war. Obama kept the war going. And no matter who you blame, I don't care who it is, be it Reagan, be it Carter, you go back as far as you want to, it makes no difference. The debt keeps accumulating. And most people don't understand this. Greece is a perfect example of what's going to happen to us in basically 3 to 5 years.
Well, not necessarily.
I don't think
because,
three to five
in fact,
years.
Wait a minute. We had a surplus in 2000, and because of those wars that Bush – and, you know, listen, Obama certainly could have ended the Iraq war a lot quicker and should be – and but
yeah,
it ain't happening anymore. Remember Iraq? When's the last time we heard anything about that? And Afghanistan is winding down. So, you know, I'm not real pleased with anything that Obama has done particularly – but I think, I don't know. But go ahead. You
Peter,
say.
Yeah. Frankly, if you choose sides, whether it be Republican or Democrat, you're a blanking idiot.
Okay. All right, what do you do then? Here's what, I never used to vote for the Democrats at all. I used to, for most of my life, I would vote for these small little parties. But, and saying, they're essentially the same. I mean, I won't even go back. I don't even have time to go.
Well, I think the thing is that what we always say on the show is until there is a mass movement of the people in this country, really the best thing, I hate to say it, is to hold our nose and vote for the lesser of the two evils, because there is not a mass movement. I want to ask you a question. Do you go out in the streets and protest on a regular basis?
No. Most people
personally,
don't.
Are you asking me that
personally? Yeah.
No, I
okay.
Agree.
Okay. Well, here's the thing: is that that's the problem. Is that Peter and I, and a small percentage of people go out regularly and protest in the streets. And until people like you, people who are talking about it, are doing that with us, nothing's going to happen. And so by you not voting for the lesser of the two evils, you're just hurting it further, in my opinion.
You know, one thing that's going on, I mean, there is this enormous mass movement going on in North America right now, and it's in Montreal and throughout Quebec, where the Liberal government, and you say you can vote for the Liberals, or you can vote for the Conservatives, you can vote for the New Democratic Party, the Parti Québécois, or, you know, local, the provincial manifestations of them. But the government tried to put this huge tuition raise into effect. And now there are marches in that city of hundreds of thousands, mobilized everybody at 8 p.m. every day. People go out on their balconies and bang pots and pans. And, I mean, it's been on every, you know, it's not the going out to demonstrations. I mean, it is, you are demonstrating your dislike of policy. But there's other people, you know, people are just doing things in their neighborhood, having neighborhood assemblies saying, look, we're not going to follow this emergency law.
Or anything, rather than just talking about it.
So they're having mass assemblies in their neighborhoods. I mean, most people are going out in the streets because at different points in the, you know, in history of modern nations, that's the way change begins. But in the meantime, I see, you know, not allowing the Republicans to get into office as not as choosing the Democrats, but choosing not to be ruled by these people that want to do even more damage to the economy. Well, damage to the people to benefit themselves. So as I always say, the Democrats are better than a stick in the eye, and the Republicans are a stick in the eye. I got to let it go at that. Wow.
Get out there and do something.
John, this is you. My sister was the emergency room nurse on that guy that shot himself in the crotch. I guess it's his, my sister.
Wow.
And yes, he says.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And Joni, who remember Joni from Farmington, who told us about the state representative, the woman who had used the word vagina.
Yeah.
Yeah. That and there's going to be a rally tonight.
Tomorrow. Tonight,
5 p.m. in Lansing. She said she thinks she heard the word penis on the radio. They say that all the time.
Yeah, you could say that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but penis say isn't as offensive. Penis! It's not as offensive as the vajayjay, you know? Of course, everything about women's body parts is, you know, somehow dirtier.
Let's go on.
Whatever.
All right, here is Stephanie. Stephanie is in Detroit. I'm sorry, in Hamtramck, and there was a caller named Eileen, and she was 20 years old, and she said she has no problem
getting a job. Well, how come these people just are lazy?
What do you think, Stephanie?
Well, I'm 20. I graduated in 2010. It took me a year to get a job, and I've literally applied to, like, you know, Macy's, Rite Aid, and I don't agree with her concept that people on welfare don't go out and look for a job. I mean,
Thank you.
My father, he was an auto worker, was working for 15 years, got laid off.
Uh-huh.
Took him 4 years to get a job, and he was looking for all 4 years.
Well, he never, and he was not on welfare. There is no welfare for able-bodied men. He may have been getting
family was on welfare because we needed food stamps.
I'm sure.
None of us had income. So
and that's how you ate.
Yeah, and you got to remember, Stephanie, that like the guy was talking about shooting people down and all that. They guys like him, these Ayn Rand fans, they just think too bad, you know, if that's the way they call the free market. Actually, it's the slave market because it enslaves all of us. Because someone like your father and millions of other Americans worked their butts off, did nothing wrong whatsoever, and got screwed badly. The people that screwed them, they're doing great. What's wrong with this picture?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm saying. You know, her concept, maybe she's too young or never experienced that, but
I thought that.
My family.
Yeah.
Well, no, you guys are the same age.
Yeah, but you know what? People are different ages at the same age, you know?
Yeah. All right. Steph, I'm going to have to let this go quickly because we're almost out of time. I've got to get some more people in. But well said.
Thank you.
Indeed. Yeah, and here's Jason in Royal Oak. And let's talk about the real welfare. Huh, Jason? You're on the air.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about corporate welfare and
thank you.
The amount of money that, you know, the real amount of money that's been stolen from this nation has come from corporations and if they want to, and Wall Street and the banks, and if you want to cut down the debt, well, for one thing, they can cut oil subsidies. That would lower the deficit. Another thing that would lower the deficit for the taxpayers would be Wall Street to pay their own bailout with the sales tax.
Transaction tax, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, that would do it. And also restore the Bush era, in fact, raise the taxes beyond the Bush era tax cuts and stop all the wars that are absolutely unnecessary. Cut the military budget in half. Use it to create an infrastructure that we can be proud of as a country rather than ashamed.
And that's efficient
for
the people.
All right, we've got to move on quickly. Got time for maybe only one or two more. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. Here is Sam. Sam's in Mount Clemens. Sam, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say you don't really think there's a segment of conservatives that actually believe that we would ever go back to being part of the British government.
No, you misunderstood me. I said that conservatives have always stood in the way of progress throughout American history, beginning with the American Revolution, which they opposed. They supported slavery. They opposed the women's vote. They opposed unions. They supported every war. They opposed unions. They opposed they opposed Social Security, the minimum wage, Medicare, everything. They are a stick in the eye, right?
Correct. Good point.
Okay.
I'm glad we could all agree on that.
All right. Wow. Here we
squeeze one more in.
Yeah, Daryl, hi. You're on the air. You got to tell me quickly.
Peter, though, I love the show.
Thank you.
I want to talk about bullying. I was bullied in school very, very bad.
Really?
Yes. September 10th, 1976, a kid decided to push me through a plate glass window backwards. told the judge I wanted to, almost killed me.
What? Let me ask you a question. That was pretty horrible, and it probably, obviously, something has that stuck with you all these years.
Yeah, now it's all the bullying is coming back up again.
What brought this to mind tonight?
Well, I wanted to talk about when you were talking about Romney picking on people.
Oh, yeah, way back when Romney was a
bully. And we always say you can bring up any topic you want on the show,
okay.
So we're glad you did.
I was just curious. I mean,
okay, these kids in school don't realize, I'd like to get more into this maybe next week or the following week.
We'll be here.
Of what it does to the person that was bullied.
Okay.
Yeah,
I know you don't have a lot of time. I'd like to call next week if possible, right, go into more detail on this.
Well, Daryl, why don't you do this? In fact, we are out of time now.
You can email us, too.
Or call earlier in the show because you caught us. I was just looking at...
Yeah, we're done with our live part by 1.
We got commercials right up till then. So, yes, call us back. Call us a little earlier, and we can talk about it.
It'd be interesting to hear something from several decades ago versus what is going on right now in modern-day society.
I mean, I went to school with guys like Romney, these rich snots.
Yeah.
I thought they ruled the world.
Yeah, I went to one of those high schools full of them.
Yeah. Is this class resentment?
No, I was actually like the class president and the cheerleader. So.
Really?
Yeah, I hung out with everybody, though.
Yeah.
I hung out with everybody.
With the greasers and the frats?
Yeah, baby.
The hippies and the whoever
the,
else?
The it was the freaks and the jocks in my era.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay, we're out of here. John, thanks for doing such a great job. He is going to prepare our podcast. It'll be available in 11 hours. Wow. And and you can find it either by going to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. You can go to our Facebook page, Facebook.com/Night Call, or WRIF.com.
Yeah.
Or
TheWhiteRoseSociety.org.
Yeah.
And he's been archiving our show for a million years.
We're bad. We're nationwide.
International.
All right, folks. We'll do it again next week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this. Man up with the ultimate pig roast and one wicked backyard bash. Keep it on 101 WRIF to win your very own WRIF man card, along with a $25 gift card to Motor City Harley Davidson in Farmington Hills. Plus, you'll be qualified for a manly grand prize, a backyard bash at your home hosted by The Riff. And we're bringing the pig. You and 20 of your friends will win a 2-hour party at their house with The Riff, complete with a full-blown pig roast, beverages, music, horseshoes, and more. Brought to you by the owners of Motor City Harley-Davidson and Solani Family Vineyards. From 101 WRIF, everything that rocks. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werbe here with you. We're all aware that there is a so-called war on drugs. And there's a lot of humor surrounding it, right? You know, war on drugs. Man, I can't even drive on drugs. And there was a referendum this last election in California that actually went down to defeat. And one of the things we're going to talk about, but a lot of jokes around that as well. Oh, wow, man, was like the election on Tuesday. But ultimately, it's not very funny. The so-called war on drugs, which I've said right along, drugs have won. In a way, we'll get into that with our guest in a second, the amount of harm that it's done to millions of people, clogged our judicial and prison systems, and that it really isn't funny. I was glad to see one of my favorite magazines, The Nation, had a special issue about the war on drugs. It's DARE, you know, that D, what we see all over, that people go into, cops go into high schools and say, you know, this is drugs, don't take it. And then kids go, wow, I didn't even hear about that one. But it, the name of the special issue of The Nation, you can go to thenation.com, by the way, is Dare to End the War on Drugs. A lot of good articles. One particularly caught my eye is by Sasha Abramski. He's been on the show at least twice, maybe three times before. The last time we talked to him about his book, Breadline USA, The Hidden Scandal of American Hunger. And Sasha Abramski also writes regularly for The Nation. We're reaching him at his office in Sacramento. Sasha Abramski, welcome back to the Peter Werbe Show.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Peter.
And I love the name of your article, a nice play on words, Altered State. I like the defeat.
I can't claim credit. That one goes to the editors.
No, well, good. Despite the defeat of Proposition 19, which was called for the legalization of marijuana with restrictions, the pot economy in California is growing in size and influence. Now, size, people have heard about that. Give us an idea what we're talking about, cash crop here for marijuana.
Well, the estimates are all over the place because almost definitionally, this is a semi-underground economy still. But many tens of billions of dollars, and some of the high-end estimates go up into the hundreds of billions of dollars. But the answer is nobody exactly knows how much marijuana is grown, how much marijuana is sold, how much marijuana is used in the state. But one of the interesting things is over the last decade or so, as medical marijuana has become respectabilized, not just in California, but in many states around the country, so a sort of semi-licit industry has grown up. And what you see in California is that there's a part of the marijuana economy that's now entirely above board. It's regulated, it's legal, its growers get protection from local law enforcement, its growers are members of the Chambers of Commerce in some cases. They pay taxes, they pay various other licensing fees to local government. And increasingly, they've got a place at the table, that they're a part of the debates around taxes, around business policy. Politicians view them as a legitimate source to seek support from and so on. And this is something that a generation ago would have been absolutely unprecedented at the height of the Reagan war on marijuana, when the campaign was going on against growers in California. The idea that in the year 2010 or 2011, there would be this above ground marijuana market and marijuana infrastructure in California, you would have been laughed out of court for saying something like that. But that's sort of where we are today. It's a huge part of the California agricultural equation. Exactly how huge is up for debate, but it's a very, very significant cash crop at this point.
Well, everybody expected, hey, in California, this Proposition 19 in the 2010 election was certain to win. I mean, you had everybody from, as you said, business interests to stoners and a libertarian streak and its social and cultural acceptance. Why did Proposition 19 lose?
Well, it's actually interesting. There was about 51-52% support for the proposition for most of the electoral season. And then about a month and a half before the election, or a month and a half before, the support began to go down, not dramatically, but enough to sort of suggest that there was soft support at its core. I think one of the things that happened is Attorney General Eric Holder made a statement. He didn't put a lot of effort into campaigning against Prop 19, but he made a very carefully timed intervention, and he said, look, Californians can vote for Proposition 19 to legalize marijuana in the state, but it remains federally illegal, and transactions around marijuana remain illegal. And one of the arguments in favor of Proposition 19 was that it would generate a lot of cash revenue for California, which obviously, like Michigan, like most other states, is suffering tremendous shortfalls in its ability to raise revenue from residents. And so California's economy is in crisis, and its politicians are looking for ways to raise money. And one of the things in favor of Proposition 19 was it was seen as an easy way to raise a few billion dollars. And Eric Holder said, well, look, if you pay taxes in California on marijuana transactions, it will still be regarded as evidence of a federal crime. And in the wake of that, support went down by about 5 or 6%.
Hmm.
Now, it could be that it was coincidental. It could be that a lot of that support was soft in the first place. Or it could be that the lesson learned here is that unless the federal government makes a move away from enforcing marijuana laws, that any attempt at a state level to legalize it will run into this problem. I think the other thing, and this was something I found when I was reporting, especially in the marijuana growing areas of Northern California, a lot of growers themselves were quite hostile to the law because they've lived quite nicely for many years. They haven't paid taxes, mostly as long as they're not too high profile, law enforcement ignores them. So they sort of have the best of both worlds. They get high prices, they get no taxes, and they feared that a legalization effort would increase the supply of marijuana and therefore it would lower the price of marijuana, and they would suddenly be faced with tax bills. And I think that combination took out the support of a lot of people who were informally involved in the marijuana industry, especially in states like in counties like Humboldt and Trinity in the north. Now, obviously, that's not a large enough constituency to in and of itself sink Proposition 19. But it was interesting that you had some law enforcement groups against Proposition 19, and for the exact opposite reason, some of the growers groups were against Proposition 19.
Sasha Abramsky, in your Nation magazine article, Altered State, in their special edition, Dare to End the War on Drugs, you, as you just indicated, you were up in those marijuana counties talking to these guys. And as you said earlier, and given the economy and the role in the economy that marijuana growing plays, these guys are really well thought of businessmen, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're increasingly respectabilized. Now, obviously, part of the marijuana industry is anything but respectable. The part of the marijuana industry that's linked to the drug cartels, the part of the marijuana industry that's funded and interconnected with the Mexican cartels in particular, it's violent, it's vicious, it's much like the alcohol moonshiners of the 1920s during Prohibition. It's involved in gun running and so on. But then there's this other part, which is sort of essentially mom-and-pop businessmen and mom-and-pop farmers. And if you go up to places like Humboldt and Trinity and Emerald counties, these are counties where an awful lot of back-to-landers basically found themselves 40, 45 years ago. And there's two generations of history where these people basically are living off the grid. They're growing a little bit of marijuana, a few plants, basically. They're essentially small-time businessmen. They're not violent. They want to be left alone. They essentially regard themselves as somewhat respectable. And increasingly, the local business community also regards them as somewhat respectable. And the change, I think, in the last few years has been increasingly the political leadership regards them as somewhat respectable. So in Oakland, for example, where there's been this huge attempt to introduce these very large-scale medical marijuana grow sites so that they can be taxed and have fees imposed on them. In Oakland, they're now firmly at the political table. They sit down with political leaders. They sit down with the district attorney. They negotiate local positions and stances on marijuana. And it's seen as being just another industry, quite a lucrative industry. So I think it's an evolving situation so that while some of the political leadership still regards any and all marijuana usage as inherently evil, a larger part of California's political leadership really is turning a blind eye at this point. It doesn't regard it either as good or bad, but it does regard the growers as a source of tax revenue.
Well, Sasha Abramsky, as usual, you're the source of an amazing amount of information. You're always rigorous about your research. But one of the things I like particularly about your article, Altered State, is you fleshed it out with a human being and begin with a profile of a big marijuana grower, Matt Cohen. Give us a little thumbnail sketch of him and how you found him and what you found.
Yeah, I mean, Cohen's a young guy, and he's growing medical marijuana. He runs a non-profit cooperative. And they grow medical marijuana, which is then distributed to users in, I think it's 9 counties in Northern California. And they're scrupulously above board. Everything they do is by the book. They pay health insurance to their workers. They pay prevailing wage rates. They pay all the various fees and regulations and licensing fees and so on that the local government requires. They are taxed. They have accountants so that when they're audited, they're above board. They basically operate as a non-profit business. And they grow marijuana in an area of Northern California. Their security systems are linked to the local sheriff's department. It's all above board. And then they distribute it in various formats. So they distribute it to smoke. They distribute it to eat. They distribute it in the form of body oils and so on. And what fascinated me about this, I mean, this is a world I'm not very familiar with, the world of medical marijuana, is that there's this industry now that has grown up that basically treats marijuana as a somewhat sophisticated medical intervention for an array of different ailments. And I think one of the problems with the medical marijuana codes in a lot of states is that they're very loose, and basically anything and everything will qualify for medical marijuana coverage. So there is certainly abuse of the medical marijuana law in California, where people who don't have any real serious ailments can go to a place like Venice Beach in Los Angeles, and they can pay $200 to a doctor, and the doctor will issue what's called a recommendation for marijuana usage, and they can take that and get a medical marijuana card, and then they can access legal marijuana in these cafes and these dispensaries.
Same in Michigan.
Some of that is essentially dealing by another name. But when you get the more respectable cooperatives, like Matt Cohen's cooperative, they're actually quite careful, I think, as to who qualifies for the medical marijuana. And there's, you know, for me it was quite interesting because it's like watching the emergence of a new medical specialty emerge. It's a form of homeopathy. It's tied in with various non-Western medical traditions. And whatever one thinks of the actual science behind it, and I've spoken to doctors who are both very supportive of it and others who are very skeptical of it, it's very interesting to watch it develop. And I think, you know, California has often led the way in cultural trends. And I think this is another area we're seeing where the ways in which California defines marijuana as a medicine and as a medicinal right increasingly has been taken up by other states around the country and other drug reform advocates around the country, and the language around marijuana has shifted, and it's become an issue of medical rights and of access to needed medicine. And to me, it's quite interesting to watch that unfold.
My guest on the Peter Werby Show, Sasha Abramsky, he's written an article in the December 27th issue of The Nation, a special issue on the war on drugs called Altered State. Sasha Abramsky is also the author of Breadline USA, The Hidden Scandal of American Hunger. Another book also, How to Fix It, and another, Inside Obama's Brain. We were talking to him in his office in Sacramento, California. We're talking about the defeat of Proposition 19 and the developing altered state, you know, of people's attitudes towards marijuana. Now, the idea, the reason that we've spent, the taxpayers, have spent hundreds of billions of dollars, maybe even a trillion, trying to stop people, as Michigan's most famous marijuana advocate, John Sinclair, once said, from smoking flowers. I guess the idea was that this is harmful to us, that the political state wants to intercept our desire, for whatever reason, medical or recreation, from utilizing this. But now there's a medical corner of this. I think they would have a tough time arguing that that the effect on the person for either legitimate medicinal purposes or simply recreational purposes would be any different. I mean, if they're trying to protect what, our health, our mental state, or whatever.
Well, I think that's absolutely right, that what the medical marijuana laws have done in California and elsewhere is they've essentially opened up the debate around broader marijuana usage. Because if it's okay to take marijuana because you're suffering migraines or menstrual cramps or nausea from cancer treatment or wasting disease, if it's okay to take marijuana to intervene in that way, then the question becomes, well, can it be that much more harmful to take it recreationally? And I think there's been a lot of hype around the dangers of marijuana usage over the 7 or 8 decades in which it's been illegal in America. What complicates the debate, and when you talk to public health specialists, they'll say this up front, what complicates the debate is that marijuana has far less harmful side effects and far less lethal side effects than a host of other drugs, both legal and illegal. Obviously, alcohol is the most widely used drug in this society, and it's got far more serious health consequences. It can wreck the liver, it can wreck the pancreas, it can cause the delirium tremens and so on. The harder illegal narcotics like heroin and cocaine, you can overdose on those drugs and kill yourself within minutes. I don't think anyone's ever documented an instance of someone smoking too much marijuana and keeling over as a result and dying, which isn't to say it doesn't have bad side effects. I mean, I've talked to a number of public health experts, and I've talked to the current drug czar, Bill Kerlikowski, and what they'll say is, look, all of these drugs are bad, whether they're legal or illegal. The question is, how do we regulate them? The question is, how do we distribute their usage? The question is, how do we make sure that people aren't, for example, driving under the influence? How do we make sure they're not doing other things under the influence that you wouldn't want them doing? You obviously don't want a doctor to be performing surgery if they're high, in the same way as you don't want a doctor to be performing surgery if they're drunk.
That's already in place, and that's common sense. So usually when we have these discussions, I feel...
I think, you know, if you'd said that a generation ago, it wouldn't have been seen as common sense, because there was such an instinctual hostility to any and all illegal drug usage, and marijuana was essentially bundled at that point with heroin and cocaine.
Sure.
If someone had said, let's have a debate about how to regulate driving under the influence, it would have been impossible to have that conversation, because the conversation at that point was more along the lines of how many years in prison should someone get if they're taking marijuana. And in the early 1980s, there were even debates about whether or not to put users of drugs, including marijuana, into camps in the desert in the western states. You know, this was some of the sort of outlandish terms of the debate 20 years ago. Now the debate's changed, and at the highest levels of government, when you talk to the drug czar, Jill Kolakowski, what you hear is, look, we know that this is a different drug from heroin and cocaine. We know it has to be treated and regulated differently. We know the penalties have to be different. And that's an extraordinary transformation, and it's being reflected at state-level policy, and it's being reflected in local-level ordinances, and it's being reflected in the fact that increasingly, in many states, law enforcement essentially ignores small-time marijuana infractions.
I always feel compelled when we have these discussions to enumerate the different people in job categories that I know that smoke marijuana regularly, including police and prosecutors, doctors and college professors. I mean, I don't know. You could probably just go down the list. I hope the doctors, as you say, are not. I asked a college professor who told me that he got high before every class. He was an art professor, so maybe that's. And I said, "Did you ever teach not stoned?" And he said, "Yeah, but I thought I was cheating my students," which I didn't go any farther. Sasha Abramski is my guest. We're talking about the defeat of Proposition 19 in California in the last election and the implications for the pot economy in California. I guess I don't wonder, I bet I know how the prison guards union voted on this, because one of the things that marijuana prohibition does, it provides thousands and thousands of clients for the prison industrial complex.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I actually agree on that one. I don't know how the prison guards union came down on Prop 19. In actual fact, there are very few marijuana users and very few small-time marijuana dealers in California prisons. There are some in California's federal penitentiaries, in penitentiaries like Lompoc, that are located in California but run by the federal government. But California's essentially stopped prosecuting small marijuana dealers and has done for years. I thought one of the most interesting things about Proposition 19 this time around was the number of law enforcement groups that came out in favor of repealing the marijuana laws. It wasn't a majority of law enforcement groups, but certainly there's a group called LEAP, which is Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Various African-American police organizations around the country came out in support of it. And then the other interesting thing was various civil rights groups, including the NAACP and I believe the ACLU, also came out in support of Prop 19. And the reason for that was there's been a number of studies over the years that show that African Americans and Latinos are uniquely at risk of arrest for marijuana crimes, for marijuana usage, dealing, and so on. And so a lot of civil rights groups have begun understanding this issue more as a civil rights issue and less as a straight law enforcement one. And so one of the things you saw in October and November as the campaign ramped up, or September, October, and early November as the campaign ramped up, was a terrific number of law enforcement voices actually came out in support of either Prop 19 or variants of some other way of legalizing marijuana or essentially dismantling the marijuana laws. District attorneys opposed it. The sheriff's associations opposed it. But it was by no means a sort of across-the-board slamming of the proposition by law enforcement. And again, that's just a sea change from a few years back.
Sure. It occurs to me that when we were talking earlier about the intervention of U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder saying, look, you're still going to be in violation, I suppose it would be the Marijuana Stamp Tax Act, that even if it's legalized in California, you're still going to be in violation of federal law. And everyone all supporters of the proposition to legalize it, though, this is horrible. But, you know, there's actually an interesting constitutional proposition here. I mean, we certainly wouldn't like it if, some state decided to re-legalize slavery, right? It would, you know what I'm saying? In other words, that there is a point. I mean, I think.
Well, I got into a lot of arguments with friends of mine around this because I actually thought the federal government had no choice but to make that statement. And you mentioned the slavery issue, but the more pressing
abortion
contemporary issue. Well, no, it's not abortion; it's immigration.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
The fact, you know, when Arizona passed their anti-immigration bill last year, and it was clearly unconstitutional, and it basically gave local police officers the power to randomly pick and choose who they viewed as suspicious, as qualifying as a potential illegal immigrant, and then demanding proof of citizenship or proof of residency. And the federal government stepped in and said, look, we're going to sue Arizona because this law is unconstitutional. It's the federal government's role to determine immigration policy. And everybody in the progressive community supported the federal government cracking down on Arizona on that one. And I did too. I thought, you know, the law was terribly worded. It opened up all kinds of constitutional problems. And it would have been a disaster if the federal government had walked away from that. But I think that given the federal government is trying to enforce its authority and its primacy in the area of, certainly of immigration, but as you said, also abortion, I think that it would be absolutely hypocritical for the federal government to then say, but on other issues, we're going to let the states go their own way. Now, as it happens, I think the federal government's wrong in its marijuana policies. But I think that given those laws exist, the federal government cannot let the states just go their own ways. And so I've always said, look, you have to have some form of decriminalization at a state level. But decriminalization is easier for the federal government to ignore than full-scale legalization. Once you actually legalize, you are pushing for a constitutional confrontation. I've always thought it would be far better for those wholesale reforms to originate at a federal level. Now, I don't know if they're going to, but I think it's a much less messy proposition if it comes from the federal system than if it comes a local or a state system, because I think that does undermine the authority of the federal government.
Well, let those teabaggers spend some time in the House repealing that federal law. I mean, given 535 people in the Congress and plus the president, how many of those people do you think, given their ages and where they fell in the culture of the last 30, 40 years, have smoked marijuana?
So I'm sure most of them have.
Yeah, so it's
done a poll, but you know, statistically, most of them have.
Yeah, so it's extraordinarily hypocritical, and it still creates such harm to people, and is such a thorough waste of money. It's another one of those Keynesian propositions where they take our tax money, they pump it back into the war on drugs, and it's a terrible way to spend tax dollars, and it harms people more than helps people. So.
It does. I mean, I think one of the interesting things about the current Congress is there's a tremendous number of conservative legislators who subscribe to this somewhat wacky, I think they call it the tempers, this wacky doctrine that basically severely restricts federal authority to pass laws and puts the great onus for passing laws on the states rather than the federal government. And it's essentially this vision of America as 50 semi-sovereign countries. And it's a completely wacky vision. But one of the things that it opens the door to, at least, is a conversation about precisely this kind of law, that if we're going to have this extraordinarily wacky conversation about the 10th Amendment, then surely we should also be having a conversation about this extremely expensive federal infrastructure around the war on drugs and whether or not this is something the federal government really wants to be spending tens or hundreds of billions of dollars on over the next many years. I think one of the more hypocritical things I've heard in recent months is that the incoming chair, I believe it's the Judiciary Committee, has said he's going to launch investigations to look at why the Obama administration has allowed the relaxation of drug penalties in some cases.
Huh.
And I think any attempt to re-ramp up the war on drugs at this point is so counterproductive, and there's so much evidence it doesn't work, and there's so much evidence that a public health approach is a more sensible approach, that it saves more lives, that it saves more money, that it's more effective at getting people off of hard drugs. Any attempt to go back to this very simplistic, all about criminal justice approach to the war on drugs, it seems to me that's deeply hypocritical.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being a guest on my show. My guest has been Sasha Abramski, and he has an article in a special issue of The Nation, and it's a weekly, so already it's a back issue. But if you go to thenation.com, and I would heartily recommend subscribing to it, I do. His article was called Altered State, talking about the defeat of Proposition 19 that would have legalized marijuana in California. And Sasha, what you have, and I should have asked you this ahead of time, your website is just Sasha Abramski?
It's sashaabramski.com, sashaabramski.com.
And for those of you driving, just go to my website. Of course, I got to spell my last name too. Peter Werbe, Werbe.com. And there'll be a link there as well. Sasha Abramski, thanks for being on my program.
Thanks for having me on.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this. Everything that rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com. Thanks for listening to 101 WRIF on the World Wide Web at WRIF.com. back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, there was an election last Tuesday, and talking to people on the street, a lot of people kind of missed the significance of it, even where it was. I said, what did you think about the election? They said, well, where? It was in Wisconsin. It was a recall election to recall the governor, Scott Walker, and also a number of Republican legislators. People, vast numbers of people were extraordinarily angry with the agenda of Governor Walker and the Republicans who had launched a frontal assault on unions, taking away their right to do collective bargaining, a lot of other things. And there's only been a few recall elections in American history. Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, was the first one ever to win one. Everyone else who faced one, they were gone. I want to bring in Andy Kroll. He's a reporter for Mother Jones Magazine and also an associate editor at TomDispatch.com. And he's just written a piece for TomDispatch.com called Getting Rolled in Wisconsin, Why Electoral Politics Sold Out the Popular Uprising in the Badger State, and Why It's Not All Over. We're reaching him in his office in Washington, D.C. Andy Kroll, welcome to the broadcast.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Sort of welcome home, right? You're a Michigander?
I am, Kalamazoo raised.
Okay. And what'd you tell me, University of Michigan as well?
Wolverines, go blue. You got it.
Hey, watch it, guy. I went to Michigan State. That's okay. Hey, I kind of gave a thumbnail of what happened in Wisconsin. Is there anything you should add to it so people get a full understanding, at least at the context of what we're going to talk about?
Sure, yeah. We had elections in Wisconsin on June 5th, last Tuesday. These elections targeted the governor there, Scott Walker, a Republican, his lieutenant governor, Rebecca Clayfish, also a Republican, and then several Republican state senators in different pockets of Wisconsin. And really, the Walker recall was the marquee race, the marquee recall on Tuesday. And it was the culmination of 16 months of upheaval and organizing and just political frenzy.
This is where, if people may remember on television, where the labor unions occupied the state capitol. This was like January 2011. Hundreds of thousands of people involved. So there was a real movement here.
There absolutely was. And it was, I was there. I slept on the floor of the state capitol rotunda in Wisconsin, and I spent weeks with these people talking to them, learning why they had occupied their state capitol, learning why they spent all night, either lobbying lawmakers inside the capitol or playing drums in a drum circle or marching in the snowy, freezing cold outside the capitol building in Madison there. I mean, it was just an incredible amount of raw energy and just, white hot anger in Madison and in Wisconsin and what they perceived to be a power grab from their governor. This stemmed from him. Governor Walker referred to it as dropping the bomb, which was a bill known as Act 10. It severely curbed collective bargaining rights for public employees in Wisconsin. It also made it harder for unions to certify and sort of stay in the action year after year, and also to collect dues from their members. Really, this bill kneecapped public sector unions in Wisconsin, who are a huge pillar of support for the Democratic Party. And not only did the governor do this, but not only did he drop the bomb, so to speak, he did not campaign on it at all. In fact, he told one newspaper in Wisconsin that he intended to sit down at the table with unions in his state and negotiate with them and work with them to solve Wisconsin's problems. And I really think that claim, and then essentially doing the exact opposite and never campaigning on it and never telling the people of Wisconsin what he was going to do, was really at the core of why there was just such an upheaval, so many protests, hundreds of thousands of people on tractors, people on other people's shoulders, people hoisting signs aloft into the sky. Why they were there was that they felt deceived and they felt wronged by their new governor.
Yeah, well, Andy Kroll, everyone now believes that Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin really had a very deep and hidden agenda, that he was connected up with the billionaire Koch brothers, that he early on had told his millionaire supporters that he was going to divide and conquer the labor movement. And as you said, the two-pronged attack. One was on the labor unions, but then the labor unions, which function as the basis of support and often money for the Democratic Party, would erode their capacity to challenge Republicans. Also, you get, you know, when you get rid of the unions, you can knock everybody's wages down,
mm-hmm.
contract all their services out, and all the fat cats are happy.
Exactly. I mean, you know, the bar to measure from here is looking at southern states that are right to work. Wisconsin is not yet a right to work state, but Governor Walker has not said he would veto such a bill. But when you look at right to work states, the average wage made by employees there is lower. Workplaces are generally less safe. The quality of work is less safe. The quality of the work, it decreases, and you have middle classes in those kinds of states thinned out because labor unions exist to provide living wages, provide good benefits, provide, you know, a higher quality of life for middle-income Americans.
Let me just remind people that right to work, that's another phrase that the right has skillfully crafted. It has mm-hmm. nothing to do with a right to work. What it really does, there are laws that severely weaken the capacity of unions to negotiate good contracts of the type that Andy Kroll just mentioned. That it has nothing to do about a right to work at all. One of the things that struck me about this whole campaign to recall Governor Walker of Wisconsin was the ebullience of some of our colleagues, like John Nichols of The Nation magazine and Ed Schultz, the MSNBC and radio talk show host. And I kept thinking, I think they're dreaming. I think they're going to lose this. And even a lot of the polls. And then when it was over, everybody started saying, oh, it doesn't matter. I mean, before they were saying this is going to be the signal event in political history almost. And then the people that were so sure that that Walker and the other Republicans were going to get broomed out of office last Tuesday, Tuesday, June 5th, I should say, then all of a sudden they were saying, well, yeah, you know, it was billionaire money and all. And so maybe that goes a little to your TomDispatch.com subhead here, why electoral politics sold out the popular uprising in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of the points you just made are right, and they're very loaded ones as well. You know, there was. Don't get me wrong. The people of Wisconsin appreciated Ed Schultz coming to their state multiple times, including this past Tuesday, to cover the elections, to shine a national spotlight on what was going on and what Governor Walker was doing to organize labor and to Democrats. It's a regular working people in their state. They appreciated that. And of course they appreciate the work that someone like John Nichols, who lives in Madison, does as well and has written, hundreds of thousands of words on the subject. But there also was a sense of, feeling like it had gotten the movement, the uprising had gotten away from what it originally was, which was sort of the mass occupation and the mass organization of people of all different stripes, liberals, some conservatives, Democrats, Republicans, young and old, working and unemployed, uniting behind what they saw was a grievous wrong done to their state.
So why did it lose so badly? That's and why did almost 40% of union families vote for Walker? I mean, it would be like Jews voting for the Nazi Party or blacks voting for George Wallace.
Well, I one thing that I heard from talking to folks in Wisconsin was that they were offended, might be too strong of a word, but there was a deep part of them was uneasy about recall elections, about demanding that the governor be thrown out of office 16 months into his first term.
Because they didn't agree with his policies. Right. Not, I mean, not that there was malfeasance or misfeasance or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe they saw something, a recall, as too drastic of a move. They may have disagreed with his policies, but they didn't like how the, you know, they didn't like that their state had become so viciously polarized by this process, by this recall process. They didn't, you know, and then, but although Governor Walker certainly played a huge role in that polarization, the recall made it even worse. And I think, you know, there was just, you know, the people of Wisconsin, you know, that sort of their Midwestern earnesty was, you know, it put them off that this recall was put on, that the governor who was elected, you know, by a Democratic election in 2010 was now, you know, on, you know, basically a referendum on him in the state of Wisconsin that was costing the state more than $10 million. And people just disagreed with the recall in general. I found that a lot. You know, the union household number that you mentioned, I think the number I saw was about 36% of union households ended up voting, which seems like completely against their economic interests. That speaks to possibly a failure of voter education on the part of labor unions in Wisconsin. You know, they convinced their members, who did vote overwhelmingly for the Democratic challenger Tom Barrett, but the message didn't sink in enough to get the entire household on board.
Well, they sure didn't get, anything like 90% even of union members. My guest is Andy Kroll. He's a reporter for Mother Jones Magazine. You can go to motherjones.com. Also an associate editor at tomdispatch.com. And we're talking about an article that describes the recent recall election in Wisconsin, where the conservative Republican governor, Scott Walker, and other Republicans, all except one, held off a recall by the Democratic Party and labor unions. You mentioned cost, and a lot of people say, well, gee, yeah, we spent $10 million on this. But let's talk about money as well. I mean, if they would have come to me and said, hey, Pete, do you think we should do this recall? We've got a lot of folks. We can probably get 1 million signatures to put it on the ballot, which they did, almost 1 million. I would have said, well, one of the things that's going to happen is you're going to draw in tens of millions of dollars of right-wing billionaire money to put forth the conservative point of view, and it could be determinative. And you know, I mean, I know you may think I'm just being so smart in retrospect, but I thought that at the beginning, and that's what happened, right?
That is what happened. The candidate, you know, Scott Walker outraised his opponent, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett, on the level of 7 or 8 to 1 in spending. Now, when you've lumped in all the unions, all the Democratic money, including the candidate, all the Republican money, including the candidate, the Republican side still outraised the Democrats by 2 to 1 margin. So they were noticeably outspent there. You know, but what you saw was just more energy and just more. The Republicans cast that recall as having more at stake than the Democrats did and the unions did, you know, even though it was it was progressives and Democrats and unions who picked this fight, who started the recall process, decided that was the path to go down and went down it. But you know, the Republicans cast this as, you know, ground zero as the fight against President Obama's, to fight President Obama's agenda. Scott Walker stood up to it, and if he loses, you know, that is a huge loss for the fight against Obama. And you know, they cast it as a key battle, you know, in defending the conservative agenda of, you know, attacking unions and.
Well, no, wait, Andy Kroll. Now that I agree with that, and that was very successful as their
messaging, their message, framing.
But that in many ways, I don't know, argues against, but I think is a much stronger element than the fact that people said, hey, we shouldn't be spending $10 million for this, or that recalls, just because you don't agree with somebody, aren't proper. Rather, this has to do, I mean, there's the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, and then it's what I call the party of resentment. And I saw this written somewhere that they said great numbers of people that you would have thought would have voted to recall Walker voted for Walker because it was attacking unions, not because they were particularly conservative, but out of a resentment that they that union members had jobs, they had good jobs, as you indicated earlier, with good benefits and what have you. And if I'm losing my home, if I've lost my job, if my salary's been cut, if my pension's been vacated, screw those union people who want special privileges. And I may not like Republicans, but I'm going to twist the knife in these this privileged sector of the working class.
And this has been something that has been underway for decades, since going back to Reagan, which is the villainization of unions and casting them as symbols of bloat and excess and pampering, especially when we're talking public sector unions, pampering, overpaid bureaucrats who don't work as hard as their private sector counterparts yet get, Cadillac healthcare plans. And, and that union resentment, that organized labor villainization definitely was seen in Wisconsin. And exit polls show played a part in why Governor Walker's attack on unions just didn't, when it came to this recall election 16 months after he dropped the bomb, that people did not rally around labor unions as much as one might have thought. And, and that's a bigger problem. That speaks to a larger sort of shift in public opinion, over 10, 20, 30 years. And that is a much larger problem that organized labor is confronting, and it's an existential crisis almost for them to make the point that working people, are benefited by labor unions, and that, as we've seen the decline of union membership, we've seen the increase of income inequality in this country, and that connection has not really soaked into the public's mind, and there is this resentment about pensions and health care benefits.
You would think people would say, boy, look at those great benefits. I ought to see about getting in a union. But given that the spiraling downward of unions, people probably don't see that even as much of an alternative. My guest on the Peter Werbe Show is Andy Kroll. We're talking to him in his Washington office. He's a reporter for Mother Jones Magazine and an associate editor at TomDispatch.com. I would tell you that TomDispatch.com is worth a look every single day. One of the articles is by Andy called Getting Rolled in Wisconsin. It's there now. And also Mother Jones Magazine is excellent as well. Arun Gupta, who's an editor of Independent Magazine, he said the Wisconsin recall election is a snapshot of an organized, energized right wing swimming in cash, a Democratic Party in disarray, a labor movement sliding towards oblivion, and an Obama campaign in deep trouble. Andy Kroll, you think it's that bad?
I don't think that I can refute that factually.
Yeah.
As cynical as reporters are, I try to be a little more optimistic. I think the Obama, there's a lot of resentment toward the Obama campaign, the president himself for not weighing in Wisconsin and for just not caring about the fight.
He knew it was going to lose. I mean, if he would have come to me and said, do you think I ought to jump in there with both feet? I said, if you want to get tired with the loss, yeah.
Yep.
I think it was very strategic on the campaign's part.
I completely agree. I mean, he was as close as Minneapolis, which essentially is part of Wisconsin, is right there on the border, and did not come into the state. The president looks very smart. The president looks very smart afterward.
Yeah, but I'm sure they're probably talking about resentment. There's probably resentment on the part of the Democratic Party and labor forces as well. And I'm sure it must have felt like the rug being pulled out from under them. In your article TomDispatch.com, Getting Rolled in Wisconsin, you say the revelers watched in stunned disbelief as big screen TV had crimson red headlines projected winner Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, who fought off the recall. I mean, they were led, and maybe speak to this a little, because you also talk about this being hijacked. Here was this incredible energy funneled into one little point, and they got their butt kicked.
They did. And, the bigger point that I tried to make with the piece was that fitting all of the voices, all of the types of people, and there was such a diverse and broad coalition of people, group of people, who rose up last year in February and March and April in Wisconsin, trying to fit them into the box of electoral politics, just wasn't going to work, and you were going to alienate people, and you were going to blunt the energy, and it was going to severely restrict what had been, you know, a captivating, just incredible historic explosion of civic activity, of participation, of just energy, whether it was in person or it was online or it was from in Wisconsin or it was outside Wisconsin. I mean, people forget that, you know, a couple of weeks into those protests and that occupation of Wisconsin, there were organizations about unions and in the middle class all around the country. There was a day of action all around the country. This was something that gripped the nation.
Sure.
And people turned out all over. And, a great example of how this political process turned people off, especially that were part of this movement, was the Democratic primary, in which you had a candidate, Tom Barrett, who ultimately won that primary, who was not liked by labor unions, who was not liked by the progressive base, who was the choice of pretty much the party establishment because he had more name recognition, and polls show he had a better chance at beating Walker. On the other hand, you had Kathleen Falk, who did appeal to the progressive base, who was the choice of the stalwarts in Madison, a very liberal city in the state capital, and she was the choice of organized labor. And that Democratic primary splintered the movement, if you can call it that, splintered that mass of people.
Well, anyway,
so outraged by Governor Walker.
Any way to tell how dispirited those forces are? I guess I would be pretty dispirited. In fact, in your article on TomDispatch.com, Getting Rolled in Wisconsin, you say that the Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett, Walker's opponent, walked through the crowd at the concession speech, and a woman slapped him in the face.
She did, yeah. He was greeting people in the crowd, and this woman reportedly was so angry that the governor had the mayor, Tom Barrett, had called Governor Walker and conceded early in the night. The race had been called, but people were saying, well, you know, don't concede, wait it out. Maybe other counties are coming in, but he had conceded and essentially sort of leaned into this woman, thinking he was going to get a hug or thinking that she was just playing around about saying, can I slap you? And nope, she did it. She whacked him, and it just sort of put a grim exclamation point on a very, very tough night for Democrats and unions and progressives in the state.
Andy Crowell, we're almost out of time, and looking ahead to the future, I know you don't have a crystal ball, but
I wish.
Yeah, well, we're talking about a Democratic Party in disarray, a labor movement sliding towards oblivion, Obama campaign in deep trouble. And the kind of resentment on lots of levels against President Obama, does he look like a one-term president?
No, I don't think so. I think that history shows incumbents have very clear advantages, and that the president, he has some of the smartest people in politics working for him. He has, even amidst disillusionment among Democrats and progressives and liberals, he still has a very active donor base. He's fundraising like crazy. I think he's at 6 fundraisers today, I think it was.
Really?
Either it was today or tomorrow, which has to be some kind of a record or near the record.
Yeah. Is it all money, though? I mean, the economy, the...
It's not all. Nope, it's not all money.
Yeah.
That's very true. And if the economy, if the economy limps along as it is right now, it's still incredibly, incredibly close for the president. If the economy picks up at all, it just improves his prospects. But if you look at past first-term presidents running during soft economies, Obama is right in the middle of the pack. You can't underestimate the clout and the power and the history of incumbent presidents. And, polls show him still in the lead. It's going to be an absolutely razor-thin fight. The results are going to be razor-thin in November if the economy stays as it is now. Any uptick in the economy is good for the president, though. And anyone who writes him off says that he is doomed just – doesn't know their history, hasn't done their homework.
Okay. I don't know. I'm a little less optimistic than you are, but
we shall see.
Andy Kroll has been my guest on the Peter Werby Show. Andy is a reporter for Mother Jones Magazine, motherjones.com. He's also an associate editor at tomdispatch.com, where he has a couple of articles about the Walker recall in Wisconsin. Sometimes people say to me, how do you know everything that you say on the radio? Well, I don't, I'm not there. What I do is I read publications like Mother Jones, and I go to TomDispatch.com every day. That's where it's all about. Andy Kroll, thanks for being on the Peter Werby Show.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIN. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit. Rockin' Detroit at 101.1 FM and the rest of the planet online at WRIF.com. This is 101 WRIF. Thanks for rocking with us online at WRIF.com. to the Rock.
Got the message?
On the web.